You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
This month's Center Steer podcast is sponsored by Commonwealth Classics. Commonwealth Classics is a direct importer of classic vehicles from Europe and South America and has a rotating collection of rare and unique Land Rovers. Their showroom is located in Virginia, just 45 minutes from Washington, D.C. Visit www.cwclassics.com to view their current inventory of classic vehicles. This episode is also brought to you by LT Wright Knives. These heirloom quality pieces will outlast your adventures, so plan well, drive safely, and carry an LTWK. Find out more online at ltwrightknives.com. The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast, the first Land Rover podcast on the planet. Center Steer is a podcast by, for, and about Land Rover owners. This is show number 72 for March 2019, and we're recording on March 31st. I'm your host, John Costage. Joining me via Skype is Harold and Morgan. How you guys doing?
Hey, doing well.
Good, good. And also, our guest this month is also joining us for the show is Dixon Kenner. Dixon is a member of OVLR and helps to manage the LRO, a mailing list, which is a great resource for serious truck owners. We'll learn about it and a great event called the Birthday Party later in the podcast. But in the meantime, welcome joining us, Dixon.
Good day. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and you are currently traveling in your Audi, and you're traveling back from helping on a Rover fix weekend, right?
80-inch weekend down in New Jersey, so most of it was working on a 1957 88.
Yeah, we'll learn more about that later in the show when we talk to Dixon, and also on a better connection. We talked to him a couple days ago, and it was over a better Skype connection, but he wanted to join us for the news here. I guess it's kind of a tryout to see if he'll join us as a panelist, right?
That's right.
An audition.
Yes, there we go. An audition. There we go.
So you're having an 88-inch weekend of bonus content.
Well, we also moved the mobile engine shunt off of Ben's 1951 over to my 1951, so we can continue moving engines from one barn to the other. His engine was having a bit of a challenge running, and with a crane hanging off the front of a Land Rover, it makes it difficult to open the bonnet and get at anything. So we just switched everything over also.
Got it.
So there was an 80-inch content.
Okay.
And I realize that with Dixon being on Skype while driving, the audio levels will be a little different, so apologize ahead of time for that. But again, when you get to hit with the interview, it's not like that. The levels will be the similar, which is, you know, our number one concern is getting all the audio levels.
So please don't quit too early.
Exactly. And it's the spring here in western Pennsylvania. It's a great opportunity,
yeah, sort of,
to clear the critters out of your truck, put new tires on it, and get out on the trail. I'm asking that for a friend. I didn't tell you about this yet, Harold. I opened up the 109, and a critter had made a little home in the front dash.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, I didn't clear it out yet because I wasn't prepared. I got to go get some gloves and whatnot.
Find out what all it ate.
That was my concern, too. It's in the cubby between the cluster and the center stack there.
So mostly it's your stuff at 8, not mine. So
yeah, I don't think there's much in there, so, which is good.
Hopefully you don't have too much new wiring in there. They love new wiring.
Yeah. Well, that's where the backup camera is, or the backup camera screen is. So it was right next to it anyways. Hopefully he didn't get in there. We'll find out.
Yeah, if he gets behind that screen, I'm not going to be happy.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for your comments, follows, likes on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and emails. And thanks, everyone, for their support through Patreon, donations, and merchandise sales. I've taken some of that money and have purchased a new mixer. It's good. That is dedicated for podcasting. It's a, what's it called, Morgan? Was it Rodecaster, I think it's called?
Yeah, I think it's called the Rodecaster Pro.
Rodecaster Pro. It looks really cool. It has gotten a lot of good reviews, and it should make the, I'm hoping, how about this? I'm hoping, for what it seems like, it should help make producing the podcast a little easier and maybe a little quicker. The nice thing is it's kind of oriented towards the non-audio engineer, which currently a lot of all the mixers that are out there, which is what I'm using right now, have, you know, your microphones come in and then the audio goes out and you have to learn about mix minus, and apparently this all handles all that stuff for you. So it's kind of like a modern Defender compared to the old Defender, right? It kind of does it for you.
I guess we'll find out.
Exactly. Yes, all will be revealed. If you wish to support the show, you can go out to patreon.com/centersteer. All the details on becoming a Patreon supporter yourself, and thanks to our Patreon supporters and listeners. And Rover Tor is donating $80 to the podcast for the purchase of his Range Rover Classic winch trays. Trays are $480 American plus shipping, and there's a link to that in the show notes. If you're in the market for a Range Rover Classic winch tray, you can help out Abel and also help out the podcast too, thanks to Abel, of course, for his generosity. I'm planning to use that money still towards getting a new microphone here in the studio, but I thought when the new podcast mixer came up, I thought that was a better call than maybe the microphone right now. And Alex in Barbados, we heard from him again, so I will read you his email. Hi, John, Morgan, and Harold. Thanks for the shout-out on episode 71. I cheated and skipped ahead just this once. You mentioned me being a glutton for punishment, but the disease has taken full hold of me now, so much that I'm going to pick up these two for free this week. He sent pictures of series trucks. I can't bear to see them end up on the dump, and besides, I plan to build a standard series model anyway as a future project. Not completely sure if the yellow one is a 2A, but I think it might be based on the rotted bulkhead. Rotten bulkhead. The green one is almost certainly a 3, but could be a Rogue 2A and Defender parts. No engines in either, but it's possible I'll put one of these onto either a shortened Defender or Disco 1 chassis, and respective engine coil springs, depending on which model gets chosen. Could be the ultimate series. At the very least, I'm getting some original front and tail lights that I can add to my lightweight. My daughter broke one of the original glass ones that was on the lightweight, so this takes away some of the pain away. Again,
does she still live with you?
Anyway, again, thanks. I'll get onto the site and see what stuff I can find to get my hands on from your shop. All the best, Alex. So it's good to hear from Alex. Hopefully your daughter's fine, right? Daughter comes first, Harold. Daughter first, then Lynn.
All right.
I'm sure it was an accident. She was probably looking at it. Probably for her was a cool thing to look at.
Well, of course it's a cool thing to look at.
And I reached out to Simon from the Green Oval podcast, and Simon responded, because I hadn't heard from his show in a long time, was curious what was going on, and he said, Simon says, we've taken a break, but planning on series 2 in the next month or so, think we are going to do a fixed number of episodes in a series, that way we're not forced to do it monthly, which was becoming a challenge.
Really? It's hard to do these once a month?
Forced.
Really?
Where does he get that idea from? Where? Why would you say that? Only starting, almost an hour late from when we originally planned to start, because there were so many stories this month. Before we get into the news, I'm going to head down. Hopefully this show should come out this week before the Rover at Wintergreen, which is an event that the Rove folks put on. I'm going to head down to Wintergreen this upcoming weekend, and then the weekend after is the Sand Rover Rally in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida, and I'm planning to head on down there. I will have stickers and I will have shirts if you wish to help support the show. You can do that. You want to chat, you want to talk, be wonderful, and maybe find some new guests to have on in future shows. Look for us at those two events upcoming. And now, let's start with the news. So first up, despite strong North American and UK sales, China continues to affect JLR sales. So JLR retail sales in February 2019 were 38,000 plus vehicles, which was down 4% compared to February of last year. Strong sales of the I-Pace, E-Pace, and refreshed Range Rover and Range Rover Sport were offset by overall weak customer demand in China, as well as the runout of the old Range Rover Evoque, with sales of the all-new Evoque expected to ramp up over the coming months. So to give you the overall numbers here, retail sales were up significantly in North America, 25%, UK up 11%, and modestly higher in Europe, 1.1%. But weaker market conditions continue to weigh in on sales in China, down 47%.
Well, that's just a little bit of a dip.
Jeez.
Indeed it was. It has been very dire in the last month or two, but I think it continues to be somewhat dire. But as you know, Land Rover is trying to, JLR is trying to adjust and do some cost savings, which we'll talk about here in a minute. But it's not. But it's good to balance that with the U.S. is doing well, U.K. is doing well, Europe is kind of on hold.
Yeah, we're doing our part.
So following along from that, JLR's owner wants someone else to help fix the business. So this article and story came out early in March, and there was like a little flurry of activity. Then it seemed to disappear. So I think it might have been a trial balloon. Here's some just a couple lines from Jalopnik. With Brexit threatening supply lines, China's reversing growth, a lineup of old sedans, and a hefty price tag on new electric vehicle development, Tata Motors is reportedly looking to sell a bit of JLR. Tata Group, the company that bought JLR from Ford back in 2008, is looking to either turn JLR into a joint venture or sell a chunk of it, according to Bloomberg. Then they discuss the Bloomberg article, but I'll just continue on here with. But Tata isn't very interested in ceding control of JLR to any other parties, according to Bloomberg sources, but it is open to anyone that wants to throw them some fresh equity. Representatives from JLR declined to comment on Bloomberg's story, but a Tata spokesperson told Bloomberg that, quote, there is no truth to the rumors that Tata Motors is looking to divest its stake in JLR. We would not like to comment further on any other on any market speculation, unquote.
Well, that's actually more than not commenting.
Again, I think another reason why I think trial balloon. That's what I kind of heard. Like, what would you guys think if we maybe, you know?
Yeah, I think you toss it out there kind of on the sly, you know, unofficially, might be shopping and see what the response is and go from there. But if it doesn't go anywhere, then you can come back later in public to deny that you ever thought that. And it sounds like that's what they're doing.
Makes sense, especially since it sounded like they didn't want to give up any control. They just wanted some extra cash.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
I would think if you wanted extra cash, you'd be doing this when sales are doing well and from a position of strength, not a position of weakness.
Right.
And if I had to, you know, ton of money, that wanting Tata wanting to keep an equity control of this thing would be disturbing to me. You know, joint venture where I have a say in the matter, certainly. But if this is all about you going and me bailing you out, well, you're limiting your options there very quickly.
Agreed. Probably a good reason to deny it immediately.
Question that came up to me was, everything we heard before was that Tata was in a position of strength. And then, like, quickly, everything, like, in a month, just like this whole situation with JLR seems to have turned on a dime, where everything was great, 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 and then it wasn't, and it was really bad. It seems very similar with Tata, the home company itself, was, oh, yeah, we're fine, everything's going great, we support, we support, we support, and then all of a sudden, everything, again, turns on a dime. You're like, well, maybe we could have some investors, or we don't have as much money as we thought we did. I just find it very interesting that it was. It reminds me of hockey players, where they get an injury and then they just say upper body. They don't tell you where a specific part, you know, on the body it is, and it almost seems very similar. Just kind of a little bit of a cover up, but understandably kind of a cover up.
Well, you got to keep in mind that Tata has a lot of other business groups, and if one of those, like for instance their steel industry, has a downturn, then that can affect what resources they have to do all their other things.
Yeah, and with China dropping nearly 50%, isn't that still one of their biggest markets?
Yeah, I think so.
The biggest, yes.
That's very quick change.
It is the biggest car market for not only Land Rover, but for everybody. It's the biggest car market now, China is. Moving on, JLR Global Executive Joe Eberhardt has a plan to make profits. And this is an interview with CNBC here in the United States. So I'm going to read you the question, and then I'll read you his answer. And there's a good number of them, and we're probably going to go through all of them, for almost all of them, because I thought the answers and the questions were, you know, relevant to our interest here. Here's the introduction, though. The transformation has been a lot tougher for the other half of JLR, which is owned by Tata, we know, but best known for sleek sport cars and sport sedans like the F-Type and the XJ. Jaguar has been struggling to adapt to changing market conditions, resulting in a loss of £281 million, or $372 million, for JLR during the most recent quarter. The good news is that after years of delay, Jaguar has three utility vehicles in its fleet, and they're generating a surge in demand. CNBC recently sat down with Joe Eberhardt, one of JLR's senior global executives and CEO of its North American operations, to discuss the company's plans. First question. Your bottom line did not look very good during the fourth quarter of 2018. What went wrong? Eberhardt. It's the result of serious headwinds like the rest of the industry. The China business has slowed down for everyone. Meanwhile, a lot of our business is dependent on diesel, which is slowing down in Europe. I don't want to say the speed of change took us by surprise, but they were too quick for us to react to immediately. It takes time to transform ourselves to the point where we can be profitable again. End of answer. I thought it was interesting how, like, no, we didn't anticipate these problems. They came at us quickly. We didn't react fast enough. I wasn't too sure that China was also down for everyone, was it? Or was it just Land Rover? I'm trying to remember the articles in the past.
I think it's been down for most everybody, but maybe JLR more than others.
Yeah, I guess that rings a bell. All right, next question. How are you planning to do that? We'll put two transformation programs in place. In the short term is one called Charge that is purely focused on cost reductions. The other is called Accelerate, which is meant to address some of the systemic issues we're facing from a market perspective. Both efforts together will generate €2.5 billion, $2.8 billion in profit improvement, and we think we'll have a sustainable business.
Charge should have been renamed to Regen.
How about Break?
Yeah, exactly.
I think they need to spend less time coming up with cute names for their programs and just spend more time on the programs.
That's a lot of money, though, how you look at it. Slowing down and accelerating in certain places, that's a lot of money. I wonder where that's all coming from, which we've talked about in the past. Still kind of a staggering number. So CNBC, Land Rover seems well-positioned to respond to the surge of SUV demand, not so with Jaguar, however. Eberhardt, the shift to SUV continues. We're now at 70% SUVs for three consecutive months in the U.S., which nobody would have expected. I think he means sales there. And the trend is moving in the same direction in the rest of the world. It's hard to say where that will end. When it was 50%, I thought it would be the end. I don't think we knew how quickly that trend would happen when we did the F-Pace, E-Pace, and I-Pace, so I guess you could call it luck. I can guarantee at the time, nobody said it would be 70% at planning meetings. The good news is that we have the product. The question is now how we react on the downside with cars that are not in demand.
I bet they did not think that they were going to have percentages like that.
Yeah, you're probably right. But it's interesting, too, that around the same time, you know, is when all the other industries, all the other manufacturers were thinking about reducing their car manufacturing and production. You know, Ford has cut it out here in the U.S., except for one. And sorry, Harold, Jaguar is going towards SUVs.
Well, my opinion has been well documented in the past, so I feel no reason to add to that.
Yes, I admit to some poking at the bear there.
No, I would tend to agree with Harold, because when I think of Jaguar, I think of sports cars. And I look at Porsche, they're still producing the 911, even though they're getting into SUVs at the same time. If Jaguar goes down the SUV road, who's going to buy it? Especially with some of the reliability issues.
Well, in that part aside, Jeff Aronson likes to throw the Porsche example out there all the time because they had to do that to survive. But Jaguar has a sister division that does SUVs, so it seems to me you're biting your sister's hand by competing with them.
Exactly. You can specialize to a certain extent.
And generally, when you have one company, it's fine to cannibalize from your own sales for something that's going to generally improve things, but between Jaguar and Land Rover, that's just purely cannibalizing sales, it seems like. It doesn't seem like there's a benefit there.
I disagree with you guys. If it wasn't for having that stablemate, I think Jaguar would be further behind because they were able to quickly gather that SUV knowledge, just like what BMW did when they bought Land Rover.
At the expense of Range Rover sales.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And well, but then, of course, they knew what they were. They purposely did that. But I think here it's a little different because it's a different kind of customer and slightly different way the cars are set up. You know, they are setting up the Jaguars to be a little more interesting to drive, whereas the Land Rovers are not. I think still think it's a different market. I there might be some cannibalization, but I don't think as much as you guys think there is.
It's a strategic decision the company's making, and it would be interesting to know some of their thought processes behind it.
Speaking of which, why don't we continue? CNBC, do you have to start thinking about dropping some of your Jaguar passenger cars? Eberhardt, we haven't yet. Despite their low volume, we think there's still significant demand for cars. 30% of the market is still a huge number, but there might come a point. It's like manual transmissions. There's no demand, so we have to exit the market. Another area is the sport brake or wagon. The market doesn't take to it. And diesel will be an interesting market to watch. It continues to sell well on Range Rover and Range Rover Sport, but we have to watch it. So a long answer to your question, if 3 years from now that 70% becomes 85%, we have to ask which products make sense anymore. So to your guys' point, if you want to see Jaguar continue to make cars, you need to actually buy Jaguar cars. CNBC, do you need more SUVs and crossovers? Eberhardt, there's always something under development, but nothing I can talk about. You shouldn't think that JLR isn't working on new products. We always are, but I don't know if we need more models. We have a broad spectrum of derivatives, engines, and price points, and we have a huge portfolio on the Land Rover side that is getting even bigger. I want to make sure that we don't step on ourselves. We have to have clearly defined and delineated products on the Jaguar and Land Rover sides that speak to the core value of each brand.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think it's getting a little too watered down on the Land Rover side.
Well, certainly on the Range Rover side.
Oh, yeah.
That's becoming a third brand.
CNBC, in terms of self-driving vehicles, you've teamed up with Waymo, the Google spinoff, will buy as many as 20,000 I-Pace SUVs for its autonomous ride-sharing service. What does this mean for your own plans for autonomy, Eberhardt? Waymo is a great opportunity for us to get into the space with probably the best partner in the business. That doesn't mean this will be our only application. We want to hedge our bets. We want to develop our own autonomous applications. If you asked me a year ago, I wouldn't have been so confident. I've driven in autonomous vehicles with Waymo, and I must say they work better than humans. I can think the consumer adaptation might be great. When I'm out for dinner, it frustrates me. I can't drink more than one glass of wine and drive. There are times when I want to have four or five glasses. At this point, I want to be able to hit a button on the car I drove to the restaurant and have it drive me home. The biggest issue in our societal acceptance of that technology, we're nowhere near ready. Which I thought was a good summation of what I've heard about self-driving cars, and which is nice to see. He kind of, I think, agrees with me on that. And next, every senior executive I know in the auto industry has something that keeps them awake at night. How about you, Eberhardt? What keeps me awake are the challenges we face that could be exacerbated by things out of our control. We lived through shifts in market demand before, but there are unknowns on the trade side that you can't plan for, like Brexit. Dependent upon what next steps will be, the implications will be significant and far-reaching for us. If there's a no-deal Brexit, the profit implications could be significant for us to beyond £1 billion. So we are already in a challenging situation facing market headwinds and structural headwinds. And you put on top of that the key political unknowns that could potentially make the situation worse. Okay. And then what about President Trump's threat to put tariffs on auto imports? And Eberhardt said, we're not sure what will happen with that. Nobody knows what will happen if cars should be seen as a threat to national security. I like that line, a little subtle dig there.
Yeah, that's just, yeah. It would be funny if it wasn't so stupid.
Yeah. But the threat of losing £1 billion due to a no-deal Brexit, I think that's also a lot of money.
So, well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if they're trying to save and turn themselves around, and they're talking, what, $2.5 billion, if I remember correctly?
Well, they do have a big Slovakian factory to go and move production to if Brexit comes to be with a no-deal version.
And there's a lot of capacity there at that Slovakia plant. And finally, CNBC, one last question. What is it with JLR and its fixation with long model names? You recently launched your most expensive product yet, but also one that can hit 60 in the time it takes to say its name. Eberhardt, let's see. It's the Land Rover Range Rover Velar SV Autobiography Dynamic. Dynamic Edition, interjects JLR's head of PR. Yeah, Dynamic Edition. They make me say it all.
I just absolutely love that even he couldn't get through the whole name.
Oh, yeah. Right. And the PR person probably had a piece of paper there looking at it to make sure he said all the things. But on the other side of that, I also don't want to see them go to adding numbers and simple letters like every other mark has gone to. I still like a name in the vehicle. You know, Cadillac is now CT and AT. So I still like that there's a name in there.
And I still prefer that it's still the Land Rover Range Rover. I'm glad they haven't separated that out.
Oh, no, it's the Land Rover Range Rover Velar.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I kind of like that, you know, back in the 70s, you know, people understood the distinction anyway, but it was just the Range Rover, not the Land Rover Range Rover. It was a Land Rover or it was a Range Rover. And I like that part of it.
That's true.
So it was made by British Leyland at the time.
Well, yeah, and Rover Cars was still an entity, so it was, you know, it was basically, it was a type of Rover.
And that thought has actually continues here in the U.S. because I still get friends who say, oh, you know, are you bringing your Range Rover? And where's your Range Rover? And I'm like, no, it's a Land Rover. You know, make that distinction to them. So that somehow that thinking has pervaded after all this time.
Yeah, and basically, I just don't get how you confuse a bashed up 109 for a Range Rover.
It's better than confusing it with a Jeep.
Hey-o.
Or a Hummer.
It's true.
My meat wagon has been called a Hummer. Some old coot shuffled past and said he drove Hummers just like that in Vietnam. That is wrong on so many levels.
Well, maybe to his credit, it was more like, you know, people using Jeep in a generic fashion. How about that, Harold? Does that make you feel a little better?
I don't know. Okay.
Moving on in news, JLR postpones involvement in major Coventry scheme. So JLR has postponed its involvement in a multi-million-dollar-pound technology park in Coventry, which is expected to create 6,000 jobs. It was a 60-acre site dubbed Whitley South. It was a partnership between JLR and Coventry City Council. The usual unprecedented challenges, external headwinds, so they are postponing. They're not canceling, but they're postponing. JLR was set to occupy a large portion of the site, which sits next to its Whitley headquarters, as part of its aim of establishing Coventry as its global research and development base. The plan was for the rest of the site to be occupied by third parties, including some of JLR suppliers. That's been postponed, and I think we know why.
Yeah, it's part of their charge stage.
Yes, that's right. accelerate. Oh, no,
break.
Break, that's, yes, yeah, break makes more sense, yes. I will read you the headline, and that is all I know the story, because I refuse to pay for Agency Spy's subscription. JLR Agency Spark 44 to close LA office and consolidate operations in New York. I think that's part of charge, right? Or break.
Well, except that, as far as I understand it, it's just an ad agency that Land Rover hired out there. Marketing too.
Yeah, they made a big deal about opening up another office in the Silicon Valley or at least in California. Yeah.
So I guess that costs too much money, so they're not doing it.
I suppose. JLR wins case in China against Evoke Copycat. So JLR won a legal victory in compensation after a court in China ruled that the Jingling Motors Landwin X7 SUV was too similar to the Range Rover Evoke. The Beijing District Court agreed with JLR that the Landwin copied 5 unique features of the Evoke, which led to widespread consumer confusion. The court ruled that Landwin must pay JLR compensation. The ruling refers to the original Landwin X7 from 2014 rather than the most recent facelifted model, which toned down some of the more blatant similarities.
And it was pretty much identical in 2014.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like they splashed a mold off the Evoke and just started making them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you can see that, they have a picture of it here. It's, if you didn't look and see Landwin on the front, you wouldn't notice.
Well, you can buy stick-on letters and say anything you want. It doesn't change what it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Two stories in the Giveth and Taketh Away, or Taketh Away and then Giveth. JLR recalls 44,000 cars over CO2 emission levels. They have initiated a voluntary recall of around 44,000 cars in the UK over higher than certified levels of carbon dioxide emissions. We'll contact the owners, of course, free of charge repairs. Found 10 models were emitting more of the greenhouse gas than had been certified to emit. Repairs could include software updates as well as physical alterations, with some of the Evoke models requiring new tires. The recall will affect versions of the Discovery Sport, Range Rover Sport, Velar, and Evoke made between 2016 and 2019. Jaguar models include E-Pace, F-Pace, F-Type, XE, XF. While most models run on petrol, some diesel models are also part of the recall.
So the Evokes are being recalled for their tires? What is it, because they emit too much when they're doing donuts?
That's the repairs. That's the repairs may include new tires. Would that be so they get a little better gas mileage, maybe?
I'm guessing, yeah. Probably rolling resistance.
Yeah, probably harder tires or something like that.
Yeah, less effective tires.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. But on the give us side, and I'm going to read all this article because I thought it was really interesting. You guys might not find it, but I find it interesting. JLR diesels well below emission levels. New tests find. Tests have been carried out on by the newly launched AIR, A-I-R, index, an online database developed by the Global Alliance of Academics and Industry Experts. It uses independently sourced test data to rank vehicles from A to E, dirtiest to cleanest, based on their NOx emissions on-road driving. Results are now out for the E-Pace, the Discovery Sport, and the Full Discovery, and the outgoing Range Rover Evoque, which Land Rover supplied on their own. And they have been rated in the cleanest A category in real-world urban testing carried out for the database. Every car rated on the AIR Index is based on at least two independently sourced cars over three separate tests, including at least five 10-kilometer trips conducted on paved roads using onboard testing equipment. The test figures show that all four models are not only beating on-road emission limits, but even the laboratory ones. Official NOx limits for diesels are set at 80 milligrams per kilometer. Is MG milligram, right?
Yes.
Under Euro 6. The RDE1 on-road test allows vehicles to emit 2.1 times more pollutants on the road and becomes mandatory for all new cars from September 2019, while RDE limits limits this to 1.5 times from January 2021 for all new cars. And so the NOx limits for diesels are set at 80 milligrams per kilometer. I just remind you of that. The results for the E-Pace are 14 milligrams, the Discovery Sport 34 milligrams, and the Evoque at 17 milligrams, and the Discovery, full-size Discovery, at 33 milligrams. And I remind you that the NOx limits are 80.
Interesting that they score so well on the NOx, and yet they're being recalled for their CO emissions.
Well, these are diesels, and the other ones were petrol, just to be clear. Okay. But yes, all right.
They were mostly petrol, but yes.
They were different. It was a different pollutant, and that's correct. You know, the key point there is that, I mean, it's one thing to control one kind of emission, but you have to control all of them, and that's where the challenge is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and diesels emit less CO2 anyway.
Inherently they do, yes.
I think it's going to be interesting because diesels really are more of a future than petrol engines in terms of the emissions and so on that they give. And also think diesels are going to be around a lot longer than people think because there's only so much cobalt and ability to make batteries for all of these fleets of electric vehicles that they seem to believe are going to be on the roads in the near future.
Right. And diesel's a lot cleaner than it gets a reputation for, but because there have been some bad politics and bad press, it's, you know, they're being blasted as being so dirty, and they're really not.
Well, if diesel was that bad, you wouldn't be using diesel engines down in mines and not letting petrol engines anywhere near them.
Right.
Conclude this article just because I found this a little interesting comment, and this is from the Allow Independent Road Testing, AIR, the co-founder here and operations director. He said the perfect example, talking about how low the NOx limits were, emissions were from the Land Rovers, the perfect example is a Land Rover Discovery, which produced NOx emissions 20 times lower than a diesel Renault Clio Super Mini. I saw another headline where Land Rover beats, the Land Rover Clio. So just a nice comparison, that's all.
Well, yeah, because the Disco is, what, five times the size of the Renault?
Oh, probably, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And it can actually do important things.
And cost.
For important people.
For important people.
And cost more.
Well, yeah, but, it's worth owning as opposed to the other.
Jaguar J-Pace, coming in 2021 on platform shared with the next Range Rover. So the JLR is working on a so-called J-Pace to target the BMW X5 and Mercedes GLE in the midsize luxury SUV segment, and the vehicle's due in 2021. And I think this is news. I just bring it up because the J-Pace, which should boast third-row seats, is said to utilize a new modular platform shared with the next-generation Range Rover and Range Rover Sport, which is due around 2021. I think that's the MLA. Yeah, that's that MLA platform.
Is that the same one that the Defender will use, or no? That's still the other platform.
No, I think all of them are moving. Aren't all of them moving to the MLA from what is it? PLA? Is that right?
Well, everything except for the hybrids and the transverse engine models, because the MLA, the L is longitudinal.
Okay.
Oh, right.
So anything with a anything with a longitudinal engine is going to be going towards the MLA.
Hang on, Harold. Just because I didn't highlight this originally, but looking further in the article, dubbed MLA, the platform debuts this year in the highly anticipated Modern Defender and will eventually underpin all models at JLR. Jaguar vehicles will be more road-biased to help differentiate them from the rugged Land Rover. One of the main benefits of the MLA platform will be its ability to support hybrid and full electric drivetrains. The J-Pace will take advantage of this by launching a plug-in hybrid, blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
So, I this is from Motor.
So they're running longitudinal even on their electric stuff. That's interesting. That's different.
You know, I think when we read this the first time, Harold, I think there was a transition period, and maybe that's what they're referring to here. I seem to recall, I think you're right, but I think that might be for now, and I think eventually the idea is that MLA will do will handle all, if I remember correctly.
Well, deproliferating is usually a good way to save money.
There was a lot of new Defender news, or a little, but the big thing was we actually had video of a new Defender moving, and there's actually two of them. But I will start with a Land Rover exec Land Rover exec drop hints on new Defender. Like I said, drop is singular there. This was, is this Eberhard again, or is this somebody else? I clicked off the wrong article. Yes, it was. In fact, it was Eberhard yet again. He talked to trucks.com, and I'm looking at Rover Parts, which is Atlantic British's kind of coverage of it, so we'll look at that. Interrupt me as you want. I'll just start reading, see what they say, and then we'll go from there. So in an interview with trucks.com, Joe Eberhard, CEO of JLRNA, shared some of the changes that will differentiate the new Defender from the beloved original. Most of all, it has to be a vehicle that appeals as a daily driver to a more broader audience.
There's that word again.
As endearing as is simple, loud, leaky Defender is for many enthusiasts. It does not make a best-selling daily driver for the masses. According to Eberhard, the new Defender will retain some of the original appeal, but it's a vehicle that can be driven every day as long as you want, as opposed to the old Defender. I don't know. I've lived with a Defender. I'm not sure I completely agree with that.
I would drive one all day long. I have no problem with that.
According to another spokesperson at JLRNA, the vast majority of people are living with this car day-to-day, so it needs to be refined and comfortable, but also live up to the Defender name. I've driven the early prototypes, and they are so refined, I think everyone will find something to enjoy. I think that's the thing to point out there. Nathan Hoyt spokesperson, I think everyone will find something to enjoy. I think you'll see that repeatedly. However, don't think the Defender is going completely soft. Just as much as the new vehicle's designed for day-to-day comfort, it's also designed to be capable. Approach and departure angles, durable components, and ground clearance are all considered of top importance. There will also be plenty of whiz-bang technology, likely at the minimum offering the off-road technology suite of the other Land Rover vehicles offer. However, that cannot stand alone. Per Pete Simkin, Land Rover Vehicles Program Director, capability is a combination of the basic physical things as well as having the right technologies. You need both geometry and the clever technology to support it. And according to Eberhard, you want to be able to scale something safely. The new twist is you should be able to do that as comfortably and unassisted as possible. when I read that the first time, I saw the unassisted as possible, and I thought that was interesting, which basically means, you know, I think that means minimal technology. That's how I took that.
That's how I would hope that he means it.
Well, I would hope, but I have a feeling he means there's so much technology that you don't have to do anything or think about anything. Yeah. Unassisted, meaning it just does it for you and you don't have to get out the recovery gear and the winches and the other stuff.
Does make a lot of sense.
I read it the same way.
We'll find out. Hopefully, I'm more right than you guys are. But I guess
how often does that happen?
I don't know. Well, I'm trying to be positive, Harold. Trying to be positive on this.
Why?
Because it's you know, because why not? It's better to be positive.
All right.
As JLR faces various financial troubles from various worldwide factors, the success of the Defender is vital to the success of the company as a whole. Just as the Range Rover and Discovery have spawned families of vehicles, a Defender family is possible, maybe even likely. Eberhard said there is potential for other vehicles. We're launching the first one, and there might be others coming. And that's the end of the quote, there are already short wheelbase two-door and long wheelbase four-door test models in the wild and rumors of a pickup truck. Theoretically, if the Defender were perceived as too soft when it's on sale, a more rugged model could also become a new family member, though this may be a bit of a stretch.
Shouldn't be a stretch.
Yeah,
that should be a given with the Defender family, that they're going to make a rugged one.
Yeah, absolutely. Or come out with a pickup now. I think that would be, given that Jeep has come out with that Wrangler pickup, it almost makes sense.
The Jeep guys are all over that.
Yeah,
they've been waiting for that for a long time, and you know a pickup truck version would sell in the U.S.
And we've just come out with Ford just came out with the Ranger, the smaller pickup here in the U.S., an updated version of that. And I think that's selling well, if I'm not mistaken. So I think it would be a kind of a smart move to move on that. Continuing, a Land Rover is also betting on the accessory market being big with a Defender. This was actually, I thought this part was good to hear. From rooftop tents to cargo carriers and tow packages, they will likely carry an extensive range of dealers, and the aftermarket will almost certainly go gangbusters for the vehicle. The future may resemble the accessory boom that supported the D1 and the D2. The new Defender may not be as rugged as the old one, and enthusiasts should know that loud and clear by now. But the goal is that it will be a catalyst for new markets to tap their dormant sense of adventure. I guess they want to be dominant. It may not be able to conquer a 1980s Camel Trophy route or drown itself in a river and keep going, but it's a still very capable vehicle with a Defender nameplate. Inspires new Land Rover fans to see new things and have new experiences. It should be wildly successful at its most vital task, inspiring the core Land Rover concept, the spirit of adventure.
The thing about it, where he says it may not be able to drown itself, if it does not have a wading depth at least as deep as the Disco, they failed.
I agree with you there.
Agreed. They did great things with the wading depth on the Disco, so they should be able to make it happen in the Defender.
Right. So, I mean, they should at least be able to get that depth. And if they can't get that depth, they screwed up. But as a Defender, it should be more.
I'm pleased to hear that they're actually looking at putting all the accessories and so on the thing, opening it up, unlike the LR4 and so on. One of the strengths of the vehicle has always been the ability to put a lot of different things on it. And that only helps sell.
Right. Yep. I would agree.
And I thought was reading that from Atlantic British, putting that together with some other stuff we've learned, like we know that the Rovers North folks have seen the new Defender. So I'm going to make the assumption that the Atlantic British folks have seen the new Defender, guessing they've been told or they have heard or they understand that accessories are going to be a big part of this. And, you know, because they probably want to keep that business, of course, and they've already seen what's coming. So pulling those threads together, it seems like very likely then that there will be accessories and the ability for cargo carriers and rooftop tents and awnings and winches and things.
It'll be interesting to see how much to that market the Land Rover goes after themselves with the dealer network versus allowing the aftermarket to chase that.
I suspect they'll go after it heavily, Harold, because they're having – that's part of the Accelerate, Harold. That's part of Accelerate.
Okay. All right.
I would hope so.
Yes.
You know, you can buy a fully built out Jeep with third party accessories off the dealer lot. You should be able to do the same with a Defender.
And I'm sure the third party market, the Atlantic British's, Lucky Eights, the Rovers North, they want to get in that business too. I'm sure it'll be something for everyone in different ways. I'll have a link to the fulltrucks.com article if you want to read that. You can check that out from the show notes. But then there was also in New Defender News, the 2020 Land Rover Defender test with 6-cylinder petrol engine at the Nürburgring. And it's about 30 seconds of it driving around parts of the ring, so you can actually see it moving. It's still in its development camo.
Yeah, you still can't see what it looks like, but you can see it moving.
When I saw this, Harold, and I was thinking about it, I don't think there's a lot of cladding on that anymore. I don't think anymore there's a lot of cladding on it. I thought there was in the beginning, but the more I see it, the more I tend to think
I've seen some other pictures of it close up or semi close up, and it looks like there is a lot of cladding.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
I kind of got the impression.
Yeah.
I was starting to think that there wasn't. That it was going to look pretty much like what we see there.
I think there's a lot of boards around the windows to change the shape of the glass.
Okay.
For instance.
Right.
Actually, speaking of Lucky 8, they recently had some photos of it on a pallet ready to go on a ship at one of the ports I think it was New Jersey or something. And it's definitely got a lot of extra padding on it.
Do you mean around the windows? Because I'm thinking that the outline shape, maybe I should be a little more clear. I think the roof line, the hood, all seem to be pretty set. Or do you guys think?
It seems to have a lot on the, around the windows, some areas around the bonnet and the front end, and actually some on the upper portions of the windows near the roof. It's unclear.
These are all good questions. I was looking at that video and I looked at some of the pictures and kind of looking at them again here. It's tough to tell, but then again, that's why they use that development camo to kind of throw you off.
Development camo aside, it looked really stable going around the ring.
It did. That's a good sign. It was actually, I think I said to you over Slack, it moves. It actually goes fast.
Which means it's not a real Land Rover.
Oh, ooh.
Because it does go fast.
You'll notice in all the pictures of this, I don't know if you guys have noticed this, there is no Land Rover badging on it at all. They especially in the front on the grill, there is the Land Rover oval is not stuck on there. It seems like they've removed that out of off these prototypes. I don't know if that's a thing. Or...
Except on Instagram recently, there were some photos of one of the prototypes in the Northeast somewhere, and it actually does have written on the front of it, Land Rover prototype, though no badging.
Oh, well, where'd you see that?
It was on an Instagram feed. It was on the stories section, so it disappeared. Didn't get a chance to make a copy of it, but one of the people on Instagram ran across the prototype in a parking lot at night under a car cover, so lifted it up and got a couple pictures of it.
Whoa. Well, that okay.
And they didn't have time to peel the camo and get a really good look?
I made some comments about they could have at least gone and taken some photos underneath the vehicle and see what's there and such, but
there you
unfortunately
go.
Not. There was another prototype there with all the funky colorings and so on it next to it that wasn't a Land Rover. It's probably a Jaguar one.
That could be.
Do you know if they were coming in or leaving the country?
Don't know offhand. I'll contact the guy and see if I can get the photos and send them to you.
Oh, that'd be cool. And then there was another video of the prototype moving, except this time this was from Motor1, the number 1.com, and they actually have video of it. It looks like it's cold weather testing. I'm going to say Norway, could be Finland, I don't know, but it's definitely cold weather testing. And there's, I think they have a minute video of it. 2 minutes and 27 seconds. Oh, yeah, I didn't scroll down. I just looked at the video. I didn't scroll down to look at the text. They actually have text. So this is... I'm scanning. Sorry, everybody. I didn't realize there were so many articles this month that I was trying to get through them all, and I watched the video and moved on. I didn't realize there were more text. This one is definitely cold weather testing. And does it say where? It does not. Did you read this article, Morgan? This is the short wheelbase, too. This is the short wheelbase and some testing.
No, I think I missed this article.
And this is the Motor1.com article. I don't know if you saw that one. So this confirmed much-awaited... U.S. return, short and long wheelbase, full LED light front and rear denote next generation will keep up with the times, as well as short overhangs. We did not get to check out what's going on the inside of these two prototypes. I wonder if this is not in the U.S.? Unless it was up in Canada, because we haven't had enough snow this year in the U.S. that I know of, at least in our
section.
Oh,
in the Midwest. They got
Midwest
plenty.
Did? Okay. Well, this has European plates on it, although, I mean, that doesn't mean that it wasn't in the U.S., though. Not sure. But there's more video to see if you want to see it underway. This does not say this is from Motor One. They do not say where they caught these pictures. Some good close-ups if you want to check that out. And moving on to, could the Jeep Wrangler steal the Land Rover Defender's thunder? And this is from Coventry Telegraph in the UK. Really, the title mentions it all. I'll read you a couple hits here from the article. It's 3 years and counting since the last Defender rolled off the production line at Lode Lane. January 2016 saw the Defender's retirement and was marked with, you know, the fanfare. However, could the Jeep be about to steal Land Rover's thunder 71 years after it served as the inspiration? The Wrangler has been around in some form for another quite a while, and in truth, never really been much of a match for the Defender, but could the tables be set to turn? Given people who want a new Defender will have to wait 4 years, well, not 4 years from now, I don't think. It's probably just going to be a year, but they might get fed up and decide a Wrangler is an expect option. The new Wrangler had its UK launch this month, having gone on sale in the US last year. The launch saw motoring journalists put it through its paces in Cumbria, where, among other driving tasks, it undertook plenty of rigorous off-road testing. Just, I guess, more of a conversation piece that there is competition out there for the Defender. An entry-level Jeep Wrangler Sahara two-door starts at £44,800, while a medium-spec Overland model starts at £46,800. Step up to a Rubicon model, £48,000, and add a few extras. So it won't be long before you hit the £50,000 mark. Like the Defender, the Wrangler offers two styles, two-door, four-door, though they're not different Defender-style wheelbases. The new Defender will continue to having a short wheelbase, long wheelbase versions. Engine-wise, the Wrangler has a choice of petrol or diesel engines, 2-liter, 2.2 diesel, and a plug-in hybrid set to join the fray at some point. If you're buying a Wrangler in its home market, you could opt for a gas-guzzling 3.6-liter petrol engine, but that won't be available in the UK.
I think, actually, the Jeep is going to hurt Land Rover. Well, at least, let me rephrase that. I think the Jeep could hurt the Defender worse in the UK market than it could here, just because there's a certain American mystique around it. For much the same reason we buy British stuff over here, The Brits like to buy American stuff because it's cool. And I think that because it's cool and it's available, people may buy that Jeep over there instead of a Defender.
Depending on what the new Defender actually looks like, the Jeep may be a more rugged option.
Or may look more like they remember them and think they should be looking like. The Jeep still looks like a Jeep. The new Defender may not look like a Land Rover.
Worth noting here that last year, more than 240,000 Wranglers were sold in the U.S. The 2019 Range Rover Evoque review. This is a five-minute video, so if you are in the market for a Range Rover Evoque model, you might want to check it out. This is a nice, I thought, review, even-handed, generally liked things. It was a quiet vehicle, as long as you didn't rev it too much. I guess Land Rover has had some trouble dialing in on the 9-speed transmission. They've gotten better, but I guess not perfect. That still seems to be one of the negatives that the reviewers call out, is the 9-speed transmission. It tends to have trouble, let's say, on the highway or going up hills, trying to figure out what gear to be in. But apparently around town, it is not a bad problem, so the reviewers recommend use the paddle shifters.
I think that's a common problem with the transmissions that have a high number of gears, that they hunt a lot more on highway.
Right.
This past week, I was driving my Jetta, which is 6-speed, came home, hopped in the Defender, and was out on the road, shifting through the gears, and I'm like, why is there no sixth? Why is there no sixth?
At least you didn't call me up and complain that it won't go into sixth anymore.
It won't go into sixth. Why? Harold, where's sixth gear? Why can't I get into sixth gear? It won't pull back.
Because sixth gear is in your other vehicle, John.
Oh, okay. Good deal. Land Rover announces Range Rover Sport with 395 horsepower inline 6 for the U.S. So last month, Land Rover announced the special edition Range Rover Sport to its lineup called the HST. We mentioned it. Like the UK version, the Range Rover Sport HST pairs a 3-liter turbocharged inline 6 with a 48-volt mild hybrid system and an electric supercharger. That combination is good for 395 horsepower, 406 pound-foot of torque, significantly more than the 380 horsepower and 332 pound-feet of torque of the old supercharged V6. Land Rover estimates a 0-6 mile per hour time of 5.9 seconds, which, as we pointed out last month, is quite a bit quicker than 6.8 second time claim for the old V6 Sport. And this is a Motor Trend, by the way, saying these things. But while Land Rover called the HST a special edition in its UK release, it's a standalone trim level in the US. The same engine will also power the Range Rover Sport SE and HSE, but will be detuned to make 355 horsepower, 365 pound-feet of torque. That version will be badged as a P360. Well, the HST's more powerful configuration will be called the P400. Finally here, we won't have to wait for the new inline 6 to arrive either. Land Rover says it's already taking orders for all three trim levels. The SE starts at $69,795, including destination, while the more heavily optioned HST starts at $84,245. We now know why Jeff Aronson, friend of the show, was traveling to Europe. Because there a flurry of articles came out about the 2020 Range Rover Evoque being tested in Greece. And we know Jeff was in Greece. So this is not Jeff's articles, but others. This is Autoblog. Nearly a decade after the model made its debut, the 2020 Range Rover Evoque still looks audacious and sleek, especially in a compact SUV class where awkward styling and proportions are depressingly prevalent. I agree with their assessment. According to Land Rover design chief Jerry McGovern, haven't heard him in a long time, the Evoque is the first Land Rover to sell primarily on its styling, so it's no surprising here that the model's redo, McGovern's team waited to enhance rather than reinvent the look. However, they are not including the slow-selling two-door coupe or the convertible. All the body panels are new, yet the model is instantly familiar as an Evoque. This despite the opportunity afforded by an all-new platform, JLR's so-called premium transverse architecture, which was spurred by the need to accommodate electrified powertrains, including the eventual plug-in hybrid. Okay, so we got to go back and do some research, I guess, and figure out what's the difference between PTA and the MLA, because two articles here have contradicted themselves. And
well, one is transverse and the other is longitudinal.
No. This says that the PTA is supposed to accommodate electrified powertrains, and we thought that was the MLA, right. case for the MLA.
Well, yeah, no, I thought that the electrification was going to stay on the transverse platforms.
So maybe one of these articles is wrong. I guess we have to, we'll do some research eventually.
Off on its timing or something.
Yeah. Moving on here in this Autoblog article, look closely and one sees the evolution in a slimmer headlamp and tail lamp unit and the flush amount of door handles borrowed from the Velar, the characteristic fast sloping roofline and rising beltline return, but the overall design further reduces unnecessary decorative elements to a bare minimum. The model has been a hit for Land Rover, selling 100,000 units per year globally, in part because of its urban-friendly size. While the wheelbase has been stretched by 0.8 inches, its overall footprint isn't. The additional space between the axles has produced a welcome increase in rear seat knee room, and redesigned mounts for the front seat allow for a bit more space for backseat passengers to wiggle their toes. But the Evoque remains less spacious than a BMW X1 or Volvo XC40. A redesigned rear suspension yields a bit more cargo space, now 21.5 cubic feet behind the rear seats and 50.5 with them folded, which puts the Evoque's cargo space on par with the BMW X2. The new Evoque's interior is modern and minimalist. The center touchscreen is similar to that in the Velar and affords dual functionality with a 60-40 split. Below is a high-gloss center stack. Features all touch-sensitive buttons, excepting a volume knob and two large dials that primarily control temperature and fan speed. There are no other physical buttons, knobs, or switches. Available virtual instrument cluster offers an even more screen-based experience. JLR's 2-liter turbocharged 4-cylinder Ingenium gasoline engine returns in the same two strengths. The P250 model makes 246 horsepower, 260 pound-feet of torque. The P300 makes 296 horsepower and 295 torque. And those, by the way, are the metric horsepower ratings, the P numbers. The Evoque debuts Land Rover's first 48-volt mild hybrid system. It allows the engine to shut off when braking at speeds below 11 miles per hour, and it smooths engine restarts. The starter generator recovers energy under braking, which is stored in a 0.2 kilowatt battery located under the floor. It supplements the powertrain under acceleration, but does not increase total horsepower or torque figures. U.S. Evoques will also get the hybrid system. Will get the hybrid system only with the high horsepower P300 engine. Other markets will get it with the P250 engine. The transmission is a new 9-speed automatic that replaces the previous 9-speed. The P250 feels adequately spry in around the town driving. It was only at highway speeds that we might wish for a greater muscle. The P300. In all cases, the 2-liter engine is muted, and we found the Evoque to be a hushed freeway cruiser, even at 80 miles per hour or better. In city driving, the highway system effectively eliminated the annoying vibration from engine restarts. All-wheel drive is again standard, but is newly able to disconnect the rear wheels to increase efficiency. Isn't the Disco Sport have a front-wheel drive version only? And didn't the old Evoques had front-wheel drive only, right? Anybody recall that?
I don't remember.
I thought the Evoque was always a four-wheel drive.
I think when they either first came out or for a period of time, there are front-wheel drive versions only.
Gotcha.
I thought of the Evoque and of the Disco Sport. Maybe it was just the Evoque, though.
I don't think that's the case for the Disco Sport.
Continuing on, despite this innovation, EPA numbers for both the 246 horsepower version and the hybridized 269 horsepower version are down compared to the outgoing car. 20 city, 27 highway. That's losing one city and two highway. When estimates for the higher output engine are 21 and 26, that's down one and down three. We're told to blame the more responsive new transmission, and we wouldn't trade away the improvement in drivability. We do note, however, that the Evoque's EPA numbers fall shy of most competitors, including those of its stablemate, the Jaguar E-Pace, which uses the same two engines, but without the hybrid assist system, and achieves 21 and 28. The Evoque's sloping roofline and high beltline made for blinkered rear vision in the outgoing model, or as McGovern concedes, quote, that tiny window at the back that you can't bloody see out of, unquote. The new version gets around that situation by offering what Land Rover calls its clear sight rear view mirror, which can be switched from a standard inside mirror to an HD screen that displays the feed from a rear mounted camera. Actually, that one video I saw, the rear mounted camera is in the antenna fin that's in the back of the, it's up on top of the back of the vehicle. The camera offers a wider 50 degree field of view, but on our sunny day drive we were bothered by reflections on the glass. Additional cameras, one mounted in the grille and two in the side mirrors, comprise the available ClearSight ground view system, which stitch together a view of what is immediately in front of the car as if the front sheet metal were see-through. So I think that was the old through the bonnet thing, right? The ground
view. Yeah, exactly.
The ground view feature might be most useful when for wheel placement in challenging off-road driving, but it will also has value in the urban jungle when nosing into parking spaces with high curbs. Additional camera angles can be summoned, include a top-down view alongside the car to avoid curbing the stylish wheels, a forward view of cross traffic. Wonder how they do that, and the standard backup camera.
So that you can drive while watching the screen instead of looking out the front window?
Yes, that's yes, exactly.
Does that mean you can like Bluetooth it to your phone, and then you can watch on your phone as you're driving?
We're back to the James Bond driving the BMW through the car park.
Don't forget autonomous driving.
Well, then you won't even need the cameras then, Dixon, because you won't be driving. So continuing on, a newly enhanced gradient release control, which I think is a new feature. When stopping on a steep ascent, this hill hold feature will keep the brakes engaged even after the pedal is released until the driver steps on the accelerator. Previously, the system could hold the car for 3 seconds. Now there is no time limit. It can also function as an auto hold system in stop and go traffic if the driver so chooses. So there is your 2020 Land Rover, Range Rover, Evoque 2, right? Should that be the Evoque 2?
I mean, it should be, but it's not. It's just the Evoque.
I don't think Jerry likes Series 2 on things, does he? Doesn't seem to.
Well, I think we're all happy with calling things just what they are.
Right. The electric Jaguar I-Pace wins Car of the Year in Europe. It edged out the Alpine 110 in a tiebreaker. So this is the first time that Jaguar has won such an award. The four-wheel drive vehicle edged out the Alpine A110, which is not a mass production car, after they tied for top honors in the first round of voting by dozens of automotive journalists. The five finalists were the Citroën C5 Aircross, the Ford Focus, the Kia Ceed, the Mercedes A-Class, and the Peugeot 508. Last year's winner was the Volvo XC40. How do you feel about that, Harold?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's better than the alternatives.
That's, I guess, true. It's better than being not considered and then, you know, losing. In some what I consider to be Defender or at least Land Rover competition news, Autoblog spent some time with the Bollinger folks, and they have a 4-minute, 18-second video on the Bollinger B1 SUV. This is the all-electric Bollinger. Recommend you out and check it out. It's actually pretty slick. They talk to the guys. They show it moving and the things they thought of and what they did. The doors can come off, and you know, they talk about the pass-through so that you can from one end of the vehicle to the other.
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, I'm more likely to buy one of those than I am the new Defender.
Why is that?
Agreed.
Because it's just cooler.
Okay.
It's more useful. It's more of the things that I would use a Defender for. That, you know, the new Defender is not going to have that pass through for the long lumber, and it looks cool too. I like it.
Even if the what if the Defender came out with a pickup version?
Well, all right, maybe. But you know, the Bollinger handles a lot longer stuff than any pickup can. Again, that pass-through is a really cool feature. It reminds me of the old Chevy Avalanche with the drop-down wall between the back seat and the pickup bed.
Right,
but,
yeah.
You know, it's got it in the front bulkhead, too, so you can send stuff all the way through.
Yeah, and it's very much styled more like a classic Land Rover or Defender.
It looks like the Defender should.
Even down to a metal dash.
Yeah, it looks like the Defender should.
It really does.
Basically, that's a video that you people really should go and take a look at, because that is a fantastic vehicle when you see the pass-through on the video and everything else. That's very interesting.
I'm waiting for the long wheelbase version.
Of course, my questions are about recharging and how long it has. Those are kind of also important questions.
Typical electric vehicle questions, but exactly. I mean, if you're just going on the merits of the design of the vehicle, I think it's in many ways better than the Defender is going to be.
Looking at Bollinger Herald, you can reserve yours now for $0 at BollingerMotors.com.
Yeah, it's too bad $0 won't be the final price once it's available.
Speaking of looking like a Defender, or like the original, as some say, what the Defender should look like, Project Grenadier. And this is from The Guardian. The UK's richest...
Project with a K, folks.
The UK's richest man, expat supporter, Brexit supporter Jim Radcliffe, has enlisted Germany's BMW to supply engines for the Land Rover Defender successor, or as he sees it anyways, after handling the vehicle design contract to another German firm. Enos, the chemical company he founded in 1998, he has an estimated £21 billion fortune. Said BMW has joined a partnership aiming to build an uncompromising new 4x4 vehicle. It called the tie-up with BMW a major step forward in its plans to build a vehicle market to consumers around the world. Enos announced a year ago that the Stuttgart-based engineering firm MB Tech would take the initial design concepts through to a fully engineered vehicle, followed by prototypes that will be produced in 2018, I'm sure, I guess that was last year, in Germany.
Well, that was part of the evolution of the Land Rover, so you know, he's following tradition.
That's true. I guess there is that, yeah, another BMW connection. Kind of interesting how he's utilizing BMW's knowledge that BMW probably got from Land Rover building the X5.
One way to get around licensed LR technology.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. That's good thinking there, Harold.
Just
yeah.
Buy the stuff that BMW stole from Land Rover.
Come on, they bought.
Yeah, that was not a buy. That was a corporate raid.
Speaking of raiding, thanks for that transition, Harold.
Sure, anytime.
Taurus yell as elephant raids and almost flips Land Rover. There's really not a story here. It was just kind of fun to see an elephant going into the back of a looks to be a 109 trying to raid the refrigerator and find some food. It doesn't flip the Land Rover, but there was a little bit of a concern there. Watch out for your food while you're near an elephant.
Yeah, well, you know, we have that problem here with all the elephants we have in Latrobe, so.
Well, actually, it is kind of applicable, Harold, because here we would have more concern with bears.
Yeah, and yeah, it's a similar sort of problem, I guess.
Minus the opposable trunks.
Yeah.
Opposable trunks? Elephant trunks?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
I think it's more a prehensile trunk than an opposable one, but...
Yes.
Finally, in Land Rover news, Hot Wheels has a Series 3 pickup available. It's a Land Rover Series 3 pickup. Hot Wheels, the Matchbox, the little toy cars. And this one even has a winch on it, and it looks really cool. So that was actually Mike, who couldn't join us today. He sent that over.
I'd still prefer it in a one-to-one scale, but okay.
Of course.
I would as well. And I have to say I'm a little preferential to the actual Matchbox brand as opposed to Hot Wheels.
Is there a difference?
There is a difference.
Well, yeah, the Matchbox tends to be more like factory original versus the Hot Wheel, which is the aftermarket enhanced version.
It's true. And Matchbox actually started out as a company called Lesney, was started in Lesney, England. Strike that. I don't remember where. I think the family name was Lesney.
Lesney's a British company?
Yes. I grew up with lots of Lesney Matchbox cars. So, yeah, it's quite a memory thing for me, too.
Yeah. I still have one of the original Land Rover Series 2 109s.
I have one of those Expedition models that came out a couple years ago. I have one of those. Actually, some coworkers got that for me when I was leaving a job. That was their little going away gift. I went looking for this pickup. I couldn't find it. Where do you normally? I went to Target. Is there a better place to go check? I haven't had to look for Matchbox toys in forever.
Probably Walmart.
Go out and check your local stores if you get your own Series 3 pickup.
Again,
going through
like
a bit of a hailstorm here south of Syracuse, so I had it was on mute. There's actually a Matchbox station wagon with the luggage on top that's been reissued that you can get for a buck at Walmart.
Oh, that's cool. Okay. So Walmart sounds like the place to go check out for Matchbox and Hot Wheels. All right. What was the German company that made the bigger ones? I have, in fact, I'm looking at it right now because I have one in, Brudar. This one's
Bruder. And then there's like the diecast company like Maisto and some of those that make them too. But
there you go. That could be maybe a whole another sub podcast, which I'm not going to do. But that sounds like it could be another whole podcast on Land Rover diecast and models.
Well, I suspect there are diecast collector podcasts or websites out there. I collect diecast cars too, but not Land Rovers, because my specialty in the diecast is things that I'm not likely to ever own in full scale.
That's a good way to do it.
Because if it's stuff I could have in full scale or I already do have, what's the point of having the model? I'll just go outside and look at the real thing.
Well, if you want to collect the Brudar ones, check out eBay. They could go upwards of $1,000 for some of those from the 60s and 70s now.
Wow.
They didn't make many of them.
That's good to check out. Well, the one nice thing, Harold, though, is they tend to break less. You know, you don't have to put a lot of miles on the diecast ones.
Yeah, but they don't do as many important things.
And on that note, that's the news for March 2019. Commonwealth Classics is a direct importer of classic cars and trucks from Europe and South America. They're a registered Virginia dealership with a physical showroom just 45 minutes west of Washington, D.C. They specialize in importing and restoring different makes, models, and variants of vehicles not originally sold in the United States. Their vehicles are imported, titled, and available for you to test drive before you buy. For the Land Rover enthusiast looking for two-door Range Rover classics, TDI-powered Discoveries, or beautifully restored Defenders, their showroom in Marshall, Virginia is a unique destination. Looking for something special? They can help source, restore, and import that special truck you've been looking for. Contact Commonwealth Classics for your next classic vehicle. Commonwealth Classics. Visit www.cwclassics.com. From the wilds of Alaska to the searing heat of the outback in Australia, what will you find in the back of a discerning overlanding vehicle? An LT Wright Knives Overland Machete, of course. These are handmade from 1075 high carbon steel and your choice of either black or natural micarta. Need something that will stand out in the woods? Opt for the Orange G10. It won't blend in with your surroundings wherever you wander. LT Wright Knives is a small company with a family feel. Located in Wintersville, Ohio, they have a passion for what they do. Anything from everyday carry to bushcrafting to the aforementioned overland specific piece, LTWK has you covered. Each knife is thoughtfully designed, built, and tested before it heads out the door. Although they look good enough for the display cabinet, these knives like to work. Put the knife through its paces and you know you're backed by a lifetime guarantee. So carve, slice, and chop to your heart's content. LTWK creates knives for bushcraft, EDC, hunting, cooking, and overlanding, so you have a lot of choices. Carry your preferred LT Wright knives model with pride. You're helping to support an all-American company that will stand behind their product with a lifetime guarantee and the satisfaction of a job well done. These heirloom quality pieces will outlast your adventure, so plan well, drive safely, and carry an LTWK. Find out more online at ltwrightknives.com. And now on this Understeer podcast, calling us all the way from the great white north is Dixon Kenner of OVLR fame. OVLR is the Ottawa Valley Land Rovers. Welcome, Dixon, to the podcast.
Good day.
Well done, sir. Well done. Where are you calling from?
Ottawa.
Oh,
capital
nice.
Of Canada.
I have not yet been to Ottawa, and I've always wanted to go. I need to get up there. I've been to the birthday party a number of times, but I've never made the detour to go off to Ottawa.
Only about 60 miles east.
Oh, really? Okay. Oh, well, I've been, you know, now that I'm talking to you, I've been thinking about going up to the birthday party this year. Maybe a little detour and go over to visit the Capitol. Dixon, you are a longtime Land Rover fanatic, involved in the community for as long as I've been involved in the community, and probably even longer before that. And we wanted to talk to you about two things mainly, which is OVLR and also the LRO list. So start off by telling us, what is OVLR, where did it come from, and how it started? Tell us about the beginnings of OVLR.
Well, the beginnings of OVLR actually are earlier than the club. Back in 1974, a chap by the name of Harold Huggins moved from Yellowknife, Northwest Territories, down to Ottawa, and he brought his Land Rover with him. He was a judge or something. He thought the idea of having a club would be a great idea, and so started putting business cards on people's windshield screens as he found Land Rovers, and started up what was called the Association of Land Rover Owners of Canada, or ALROC. He got that going on a national basis. And after about 10 years, they ran the Transfer Box, and so on was the magazine that came out of Ottawa. Some of the people in various regions of Canada decided they thought it would be interesting to have chapters. Roverlanders in BC is an example. OVLR was actually the first chapter that was formed in 1984. So you had the two organizations running in parallel until ALROC finally fell apart, probably in the early 1990s sometime. So LVLR has then continued on since 84 all the way till today.
What about the other subclubs or chapters, I guess? Have they continued on?
Roverlanders in BC is quite strong and going. Most of the others have disappeared. Prairie Rovers is gone. There was an Alberta club that's been replaced a couple of times. I'm not sure what the status is out there. I think there's still one out there. There was relations with TARC, which was the Toronto Area Rover Club, but it was always more aimed at cars. And the others they've just vanished. If you go onto the Land Rover FAQ, there's a section on clubs historically in North America that Ben Smith and I have been able to put together of who's been where and roughly how long they were around, if they had a club newsletter and things like that.
Where would folks find that?
Oh, www.lrfaq.org.
There we go.
It's primarily a series-oriented Land Rover frequently asked questions page that actually came out of the LRO list.
We'll get to the LRO list. OVLR stands for Ottawa Valley Land Rovers, and that's been going on since, so it sounds to me like the early 80s or mid-80s.
1984 was the first year. It was Operation Frank for about a year before that, put out a bunch of newsletters and so on, and then they formed themselves into a chapter under ALROC and then continued on with a monthly newsletter and a variety of events. The birthday party, which started in 84, it's, I think, the longest running continuous Land Rover event in North America. It runs the Maple Syrup Rally in the spring at irregular dates, depending when Mother Nature says. And that, I think, is going to be possibly the second oldest Land Rover event on the continent that's been running since, I think, 86 or somewhere around there. So it's got a couple of very long-term events, and then it does small things and people tend to show up in at other events all over the place.
The birthday party takes place, about 60 miles west of Ottawa and north of Toronto, if I'm not mistaken. Is it still in that location?
Way east of Toronto.
Okay.
North by, in terms of latitude, but it's way east of Toronto.
Okay.
It's parallel in latitude to Ottawa. And it's near Silver Lake.
That's it, Silver Lake.
Maberly is, or the village of Maberly is the closest place. It's been there probably since the late 1990s in that area.
Oh, okay.
Before that, it was near Almont on the land that used to be, or was the original site for the Diefenbunker, which was a nuclear war type bunker the federal government was going to build, but it was too wet there, so they built it closer to Ottawa.
Fair enough. Okay. And so is there still that restaurant that's out in front of the, there's like a federal or provincial park there?
The restaurant's gone. Hotel is gone, unfortunately.
The event couldn't sustain the that restaurant, huh?
Oh, that'd be a whole long tangential conversation about how travel and so on is changing from the 60s.
Yeah, that's
people
true.
People just don't stop as much as they used to.
No, they don't. Well, they don't need to, right? I mean, that's true. I mean, that's the same thing happened here in the PA Turnpike. They used to have service centers about every hour or so, every 60 miles or so. And
well, now there's what like you get three. For buying vehicles that don't break.
that don't have to crest the mountain and wait to cool down before they go back down and do the mm-hmm. next hill.
Yeah. For instance, yes.
Or are even comfortable to ride in for very long periods of time.
Or hold a conversation, or yeah.
I mean, geez, where's your sense of adventure, people?
I know.
Terrible.
It is. So it still takes place at Silver Lake. How many, there's a system of trails. Do you guys maintain that?
Some of them are maintained. There's a lot of Crown land up in the area where the provincial government, the Crown owns all the land. And so there's access trails and so on there. And there's other 4x4 clubs and so on that also are creating and maintaining the trails. So it's
good.
Not that difficult to actually keep a lot of it going.
Right. Well, that's good. So there are other uses then by the clubs. That's good. Do you do any maintenance of the trails, or is it just show up and off you go?
I haven't really in a very long time, but other people in the club are certainly very involved in building rebuilding bridges and keeping the trails and so on going with some of the other clubs.
I always remember hearing stories about it from Bill Fischel, and then when I actually went up there, and it was always interesting. My one memory, and this has I have several memories, but the one that always comes to mind as soon as I think of the birthday party is all of the mosquitoes.
There are a few up there.
This birthday party takes place in June, usually the second Saturday, I think, of June. And
the weekend closest to the solstice,
and the bugs are quite.
I would think that would be early in the mosquito season, really.
It is. It all depends on the snow and the winter and
right.
what's going on. Because there have been some events where you're just carried away by them, and others where they're actually fairly benign.
Yeah, I remember growing up in Minnesota, the mosquitoes didn't get really bad till end of July, early August, and then they were bad by then.
Yeah,
it all depends when the ice gets off the lakes and so on.
Well, that's part of it, yeah.
Yeah, I think this had to be like 2004, maybe. That sounds familiar. We drove up and we set up camp and about... They were sitting there having a beer, just waiting, and all of a sudden, mosquitoes found us.
Yeah, in Minnesota, we called them the state bird.
Those are black flies up here.
Yeah, the black flies, too. Yes, that's right. There were a lot of black flies, yeah. That is why, to this day, I still carry bug spray in my vehicles because of that from the birthday party event, because there were just so many of them.
Well, the alternative is if you want to camp for free, you go to the main site. And if you want to pay a few bucks, you go to the provincial park, which actually has very few mosquitoes there.
Oh, this was the provincial park. It was right next to the lake. It was bad. How does the event take place for those who haven't been? Is it fairly informal? Are there formal trail rides?
There's a mixture. It's fairly informal. There are organized trail rides and so on for the people that really don't know the trails or what's out there. But a lot of people will go and just get behind people that have been there several times before and just follow along, whether it's the original light off-road trail, the Bolton Creek Trail. There's a number of them around there. And there are maps that are given to people and such. GPS and mapping and so on is just night and day compared to what it used to be. It's rather hard to get lost.
The site is, do you guys still have put up a tent and have some food vendors and things?
The Albatross, the club expedition trailer, is there with a couple of large tents nearby to cover everyone in case of rain and to eat underneath. The usual porta potties and such like that. The meals for the last probably decade and a half have been catered in rather than going and using the club trailer to try and cook for all these hordes of people. In that sense, it's very well organized and such.
It is.
There's information about it on the OVLR.org website, appears in the newsletter. The Facebook page will have a lot of information about it also.
Is there a fee, or do you guys charge?
Yeah, there is a fee for it. I'm not sure what it is going to be this year offhand. I haven't seen all the propaganda yet.
Sure. But it's we're talking like $100, $50 generally?
Probably about $50, $60.
That's
certainly a lot cheaper than a lot of the American events. Yeah. And then the Canadian dollar is more of a northern peso at this point in time. It was 70-something cents each.
I was going to ask whose dollar we were talking about here. Yeah. So.
Oh, Kanakistan.
What about fuel? Because, you know, I assume travel, as we talked earlier, has changed a bit. What's availability of diesel and gasoline?
Lots of availability of both. Currently, they have to do all the conversions, but it's about $1.15 a liter Canadian. So that comes down into the low 80 cents per liter, then multiplied by 3.84 or something like that, yeah. 3.72 liters per U.S. gallon.
Yeah. So about three and a quarter a gallon, maybe, in American dollars.
It's like being in Pennsylvania compared to New York State or New Jersey.
Already pay those prices, see?
Yeah, we pay more than that here because our taxes have gone up on fuel.
Paid $3.45 for a gallon of diesel this past week.
Right.
So there's places to stay, whether it's a provincial park or whether it's on the, what's the main site called? I guess just, is there a field there?
It's just a field a little bit north of Maberly. Used to be just south of Silver Lake, but it's moved over to another site now.
Oh, okay.
Again, I would say that the website or Facebook for the maps and directions to actually get there.
Right, exactly. And so there's fuel and food. Is that similar to...
Food's catered in for a couple of the meals, and the rest of it, well, you're on your own, or you can go into Perth, or there's a restaurant in Maberly. You can go into Perth, which is a small town, probably about 15 minutes to the east, that has all sorts of pubs and everything else there. Okay. There's a fair number of opportunities around.
Yeah, sounds all like Mar, really, in the way things are done.
Very similar, but smaller. The Mar tends to be huge.
Right. Yeah. So, what are the number of trucks typically you get, or people you get to the event on average?
Probably about 40 trucks or so.
Yeah.
Currently, right. It's been higher than that. It's been lower than that. It all depends on year. You know, the key things that causes issues with people is basically the end of the school year, how close you are to Canada Day, and which weekend it falls on. Because we have the 1st of July is a holiday. If the birthday party falls closer to Canada Day, people tend to not want to do a double header or travel or things like that. So a lot of it's timing. So it goes up and down, but there's always a good turnout there.
I encourage people to go. It's a fun event. Haven't been for a long time. It was fun. When we would go up, our club, we'd get together and meet up, and then we, of course, you have to go around Lake Erie and crossing over into Canada. We'd take a ferry from the American side to,
Wolf Island.
To Wolf Island, yeah. Take the and then you would make the border crossing. This small ferry, which held like two vehicles, took you to Wolf Island, and then there's that's the border crossing. I'm sure it's different now since 9/11, but, and then Wolf Island, you drive across Wolf Island to the proper sized, very large, fitting, five cars abreast on the Wolf Island ferry. That's a nice ferry.
You'll find that the customs coming into Canada really hasn't changed from before.
Oh, okay.
It's fairly reasonable.
It's
things a little more seriously.
Yeah, it's the getting home again that's the hard part.
Getting into Canada recently, I'd say in the last 5 years, they've upped their less friendly game. They're a little more less friendly. How about that?
It depends. There's a lot of cross-border information being shared now. They know when you leave the United States and come into Canada, and they know when you're coming back into the States.
Oh, yeah.
It'd be an entirely different conversation if you want to talk about what they know and what they don't know. A lot more than you think.
I think we do know, actually. And yeah, there's a reason there's not a wall there, because there's other information exchange, so you don't have to worry about that.
The secret for dealing with border officials is answer their questions exactly what they're asking for in the fewest words possible.
That's yes. And yeah, don't add anything, don't subtract anything, just answer the question. Yeah, it was coming back from, I think, the birthday party one time. I was coming back, and the American side, he asked me, how much money do you have on you, American? And I said, I don't know, $20. He goes, how much money do you have on you, American? I'm like, I think it's 20. He goes, how much money? I'm like, went in my pocket, looked, I had $20.25. Okay, go ahead. Yeah. So yeah, exactly. As soon as you ask the question the exact right way. The last time I actually came back across the border, I was coming in from Quebec and into the American side, and I was in the Defender, and they can I get out of the truck? No. Okay. Wind the window down, and he asked me, took the passport, and then he asked me, where'd you get that? And I said, the UK imported it. And he goes,
Do you have the title? Or the the registration. Do you have the registration? Yes. Can I see the registration? Sure. yes, answer the question as he asked. He didn't ask to see the registration. He just wanted to know if I had it. Fun times. So yeah,
border crossings are always fun.
Yeah, they are. Yes. You need to take them seriously. And as you said, just ask the question and answer the question that's asked. Nothing else. Nothing more. So the birthday party takes place, as we said, in June, close to the solstice. How did that happen?
Well, the club's birthday is the solstice.
Okay, and hence the name birthday party.
That's where it got its name from. And this year, it's, I believe, the 22nd and 23rd of June. Actually starts on the 21st, which is the solstice.
Yes, looking at the calendar, yes, June 21, 22. So there you go. And so that's the OVLR birthday party, and always taking place close to the solstice, and it's a fun time. It seems kind of a very laid back and chill event, not too stressful, but make it up there, and it's a good time. Good trails. How would you rate the trails as far as difficulty types and damage level?
That's a difficult question. The light off road, for example, there's water that will be crossing your floors of your vehicle. A lot of it comes down to the individual and how prepared they are. I've seen people go in with street tires on a Range Rover and have a horrible time. I go through there in my 80 inch and have no problems whatsoever. A lot of it all comes down to the driver, how they handle it. There's really nothing that difficult. There is the heavy off-road if you want to go into an all-day long mud bogging section or session. And I think in only 1 year has vehicles actually gotten through that trail and not had to turn back.
There you go. There are some that feel they're not having fun till they've broken something.
Oh, yes.
So this would offer them something to do.
Oh, very much so. That's always an entertaining one.
What's the name of that part of that trail called? Does it have a name?
It's just the heavy off-road. It's along the follows the power line between the rail line and the Highway 7. It has no name that I know of. So for the last couple of years, to go from the rail line to the heavy off-road trail, the ditch has been filled with a bit of water from some beavers. So your firewall is going to go underwater as you come down and up out of the thing. So it will thoroughly clean your vehicle.
So a snorkel would be a good idea.
Or go fast and don't get stuck.
I think I like the beaver aspect of it. That could be a name for it.
There's been some beaver dams on the light off road where when you drive down some of these submerged causeways, you dip and you go right under in the front of the vehicle and then immediately come up again. It's quite spectacular and interesting. Your biggest challenge is the duckweed that gets stuck in the radiator that you have to watch for.
What is duckweed?
Oh, it's just a fine weed that grows in the water and will clog up the radiator on some vehicles.
So is it generally flat ground? Is there rocky sections?
It's Canadian Shield, undulating land and so on. It goes up and down. It's not that flat, but again, no real rock sections. There is a rock garden to go and play in on one set of trails with some hill climbs that most vehicles don't generally make up. Basically, there's everything on offer there, depending on what you're going to look for.
Yeah. So what do you drive, and how did you get into the Green Oval?
Well, the current daily driver is a 1951 80-inch that I picked up in 1998 for $450. And then spent, about 16 years.
You won't get
years.
Any part of it for $450 anymore.
Probably not. But I was originally into Austin Minis and such. And
right on.
Back before the internet, always was interested in Land Rovers from, Wild Kingdom and Doctari and all those type of things. But try and find one. If they appeared in the classified pages, if you happened to actually see it, by the time you got around to phoning, it was usually gone. I got what I called the BGB or Big Green Beastie back in the very late 80s when I was over at a friend's place at another friend, and we were discussing Land Rovers, and he asked us to describe what one looked like. We described it, and he said, I think there's one across the street in the garage, but it hasn't moved in 20 years. So we put down our beers, walked across the road, and there it was. So I knocked on the door and asked the guy what he was doing with it, because It hadn't moved. He said, "Do you want to buy it?" Sure. So I got my friends, I think it was a Bronco or something, and we towed the thing home and then went to slowly over about a year and a half and so on, rebuilt it. In that time period, I discovered OVLR as a club. A bunch of them came over and helped me rebuild the vehicle. It was very different from Minis, that's for sure.
And yeah, Mini's one of the few vehicles that can make an 80-inch Land Rover seem big.
Yes. Still have one in the backyard. It's another project.
Well, do you still have that one that you found?
The BGB?
Yeah.
No, I sold it to a friend a couple of years ago who is taking the whole thing apart and rebuilding it. It's going to be magnificent.
Complete restoration?
Complete restoration right down to every last nut and bolt.
Wonderful. Okay, there sounds like another guest for the show. So that was a 51 Series 1, 80-inch?
The 51 is the current one. It was a 64 109 station wagon was the first one I had.
Ah, okay.
And then they started, once I was in the club and the internet started, well, the internet really didn't get going to about 98. But once I was in the club, I started finding more of them. I think I was up to 12 at one point before I realized I should.
That's a good number.
Yeah, that's a healthy myself. Number.
So dropped it down. But I'm back up to, I think, 5 right now.
Now, were all 12 functional and drivable? Of course not.
No, they weren't.
Of course not. Yes, I knew that, but I just have to ask.
No, the most I had running at any one time was been 2. The Little Earth Pig was a Series 288. It and the BGB coexisted for a while, then I sold that. Rebuilt a 69 Dormobile, and then that sold down to the United States.
Oh, nice.
Very nice.
But I've got...
Who has the Dormobile, do you know? Or is it
still? You had to ask me that question. If I had gone and continued to talk, I would have gone and named him Sean something.
Okay, that's
lives
fine.
Lives in Roslyn on Long Island. Right now I've got a 50, 51, 52, 80 inches. All the parts to build another early 2A wagon and a 76 forward control 101.
Whoa. Right on.
And do I gather that you frequently have what are dubbed 80-inch weekends?
Yes. If you're on Instagram and you type in pound 80-inch weekend, all is one word, you'll see that there's been quite a few of them that go on down in New Jersey, along with the other hashtag of pound Rover night, which is an almost weekly affair here in Ottawa where people gather to work on someone's Land Rover and try and resurrect it.
Very nice.
And I believe the 80-inch weekend is where you drive to New York, I think, for a weekend?
I just drive down to central New Jersey.
Central Jersey.
666 kilometers. A very convenient number.
That is memorable.
Which is, ironically, the distances between myself, Ben Smith in New Jersey, and Bruce Fowler in Maine averages out to about 666 kilometers. So it's the triangle of evil.
Nice.
That might be a show title, Triangle of Evil.
At least it's not the kind where, like, no rover can ever leave that triangle or anything.
Well, they all have to be running. One end of the triangle, you've got the Winter Romp. You've got Blacker Than Night in New Jersey at the southern end. And you've got the birthday party and other antics up with OVLR at the top or on the western end.
It's a pretty good trifecta.
Mm-hmm.
So what is Blacker Than Night? That's not an event I've heard of.
It's a small event in central New Jersey that Ben Smith runs. It's more of an invitational along the lines of Guy Fawkes or some of the other small events, series-oriented.
You're not cool enough to know about that, John.
I just found that out. You're absolutely correct. Well, I do have a Series 3. Does that that might get me in the club?
It might start to. Ben does have a Series 3, though to me they're the beginning of the evil influences of British Leyland. They do have plastic dashes and things like that.
They do.
They're more comfortable, I understand.
Yeah.
Negative Earth. There's a sign of the devil.
Sounds to me like almost 20 different rovers over the 30 or 40 years now. Which ones stand out to you? Any highlights? And sounds like nothing older than 76 then, touching on your Leyland influence.
That would be the newest one, from 50 to 76, I guess. I much prefer the Positive Earth ones for the simplicity of them. The 80-inch is a delightful, small, nimble vehicle. I could go on for a while about how it's not a very well-designed vehicle, especially compared to an 86-inch. But
please do. That's why we're here. Please do. That's not something we normally get to hear about.
Well, the 80-inch was a stopgap. The bulkhead is pressed. It's not very strong. When you compare an 80-inch bulkhead with an 86 all the way to basically Series 3 bulkhead or into the Defender, it's much more angular. It's got the center uprights and so on. So it's a much stiffer, much better built thing. Having the brake pedals and so on going through the floor where they're going to catch all the mud, salt, and everything else compared to the Pendulum style that they went to was, makes it actually, that's more of a 2A Series 2 thing.
Right. Yeah, that's a Series 2 thing, the Pendulum pedals.
Yeah, the 86, it's got a larger load bed in the back, so it's more useful and so on. A lot of small things.
It's just, it's tough to package the drivetrain into the 80-inch wheelbase without having ridiculously short drive shafts and bad angles to the U-joints.
All of them from 80-inch through to early 2A are very simple vehicles, very easy to maintain.
Oh, yeah.
Is any of those your daily driver, or do you drive something more modern?
In the summer, I'll use the 80-inch. In the winter, I've got a diesel Audi, which averages about 42 miles to the gallon when I'm not towing something, and 29, 30 miles to the gallon when I'm flat towing the 80-inch behind it. One has to be fuel efficient occasionally.
Occasionally, yes. To fuel efficient to have fun.
Well, the Land Rovers, the 80-inch through the early 2As, they can, get 20, 21 miles to the gallon out of them if they're tuned properly.
I guess you have a mixture of diesel and gasoline in your fleet then?
Oh, no. The Audis are diesel. All the Land Rovers are petrol.
Hmm. So what's the status of the 101?
The 101 has been now moved into the barn, and it will be a future project. It's the next project in the queue. Right now I'm doing a bunch of work on a 57 for a chap in Connecticut. And when that's done, do a bit more work on the 51. And the project after that is we have another 80-inch frame sitting in the barn, which was badly salted and rusted. We're reinforcing and rebuilding that enough to go and put a drivetrain into it so we can then go and run a rear PTO Koenig onto the front of Ben and my 80 inches.
Wow, cool.
And do it the way that PTO is supposed to run up underneath the driver's floor, which we didn't think was possible until I saw an advertisement for Ramsey rear PTO winch, which the Koenig is essentially a copy of, installed in a Jeep, Willie's Jeep from the Second World War, which, as we know, the 80-inch was designed around. And here was the solution for how to go and run a three-part drive shaft from the back of the gearbox all the way forward to the winch. Both be able to have mechanical winches on the front of the vehicles to use.
Very nice.
And the 101 is going to be kind of an off-road vehicle, or are you going to turn it into like a camper or anything like that?
It came with a homemade camper body. If someone wants it, they can have it. It's an ex-Luxembourg. It'll go get restored back into being a GS, General Service 101, and we'll see where we go from there.
So it's Luxembourg, it's left-hand drive then?
It is, yes.
Cool.
Is this something you tend to keep then, or it sounds like you like to fix things up and then find a new home for them?
It depends. Fixed up the Series 2 and the Dormobile, but the 101 has been something I've been looking for a long time. We'll see how it works out. The biggest issue with the 101 is how well can I actually drive the thing, because it isn't the most comfortable. I have some knee problems, and that finished me on 88s. There's a few inch difference between the size of a 109 versus 88 in terms of where the rear bulkhead is and how the seats go. And that makes a huge difference on where your knee is when you're trying to go and hold an accelerator pedal down. Over long periods of miles, it got to the point where I just couldn't drive an 88, so I have no problems with 109s.
Well, if the problem is the accelerator, a brick will take care of that problem.
That's true.
on a rope so that you can pull up on it when you need to slow down.
That's what the kill switch is for.
That's also what the hand throttle is for in the center of the dash.
That's true. Yeah, you can use that. Yeah. That's
hand throttle, brick, they pretty much do the same thing.
That is true.
I like to point that out to my 109 and tell people it's cruise control. What?
Like, oh, yeah, it has all of our conveniences. Cruise control, climate control.
Speed referenced automatic climate control.
It is.
It also has speed.
Optional bug screens.
And it has speed compensated noise. Faster you go, the noisier it is. Yeah. How many of the five are functioning then? It sounds like the 101 needs work.
The 101 needs to be, the engine needs to be put back together again. When I bought it, the engine was apart. It came with a lot of boxes of parts and so on. So that'll go back together again and redo the hydraulic system and it should go. The 50 needs a lot of parts that actually are dated. It was a complete running vehicle, probably about 20 years ago. It was bought by a chap, or actually by three people, who brought it down to little more than a rolling chassis with the bulkheads there, the rear box, and a lot of it's there. But the engine drivetrain is, engine gearbox and so on is gone. The front wings are gone. Breakfast and such are all gone. To go and rebuild it as a 50, because it's one of the very early ones that came into North America, need to go and get the parts that actually go on it for that year. I've got parts for 51, 52, 53 and such, but they're not the correct ones. So it's to find the right parts, rebuild that one. And just for Harold's reference, that particular Land Rover was $90.
Wow.
At 90 Canadian.
Yeah, there's actually a bit of an amusing anecdote with
so
it.
So 50 bucks
it,
then.
When I got it, I was curious to know when it was built. So I wrote Land Rover a letter saying, here's the serial number and so on. And, oh, by the way, the numbers on the axles don't match and so on. I thought they did. Could you explain this to me? I got a very nice letter back from Mr. Pagan at Land Rover Traceability that said that, well, obviously, the front axle went to Tanganyika. The rear axle went to, I think it was Uganda. The chassis went to Canada. And somewhere along the line, well, the vehicle obviously had to have the axles replaced. So they were shipped from Africa to Canada. And it was all put together. And this is why your vehicle has things that don't match. Well, I did get the build dates and so on for the African vehicles, which actually went into the Land Rover FAQ. On the pages where we have all huge thousands of serial numbers of vehicles and the build dates and their original colors and where they were supposed to have been shipped to. So that was interesting. Oh, and the 52, Harold, it was free. It was given to me.
I'm not exactly sure why I'm the recipient of the pricing of all this stuff, but okay.
You were convenient.
All right.
So Dixon, sounds like you're a series guy.
I'm an easy target.
Sounds like you're a series guy through and through. Any interest in any of the slightly more modern? I won't even ask you about the current state car. Have you thought about a Disco One?
Driven one, thought about it. At one point nearly got a Disco One, but in the end went with a different vehicle as a daily driver. I find the modern stuff, the reliability just really isn't there. And, well, they actually all look kind of bland now. I'm not sure I would touch one of the modern ones.
Well, you wouldn't be able to work on it, and that kind of is a big detractor.
No, and when you've got a company that's reveled in the bottom of the J.D. Powers reliability stats, and then you've got the Freelander, which I would argue there are more 80-inch Land Rovers on the road in North America today than there are Freelanders on the road in North America today.
As it should be.
That's not a good statistic.
As it should be.
I think you are correct on that. I don't think there's any debate on that one, Dixon. Having brought my Freelander to the birthday party, I was one of the few I think that actually showed up ever in a Freelander at the birthday party.
Freelanders are good for catching falling chimneys, and they're hardly fit for that.
Yeah, that's I know. Thanks for bringing me down, Harold. Thanks.
Uh-huh. Sure. Anytime.
I know.
Well, if you've still got it, you can give Roy Caldwell out in Helena, Montana, a ring. He's got the Western Hemisphere Area Freelander Enthusiasts Group.
Oh.
Because he's trying to rebuild or make a Freelander alive again, which is proving to be an interesting adventure because every possible dealership that anyone has contacted, we've contacted them here in the East to try and find any of the special tools, all tossed out a long time ago with gusto.
We might have a truck for him, Harold.
Yeah, I'd sell him parts, that's for sure.
Yeah, that sounds like a opportunity for that, yeah. Actually do something with it.
I met him through the LRO list, which is a very interesting community. It's much diminished, but it was an offshoot of the British Cars mailing list back in the late 80s.
So yes, give us the background of what the RL, and for our listeners, the RL list is the Land Rover owners list. It's a text, it's an email only kind of text situation. Where'd it come from? And
it dates back to dial-up BBSs, doesn't it?
I'm not, the LRO list itself, and there's actually a bunch of child LRO lists for different regions. There's an Australian one, a South African one, a UK one, and then the main LRO list, which is more North America oriented. It was formed as a split off of the British Cars mailing list, which was an early internet mailing list running through Unix to Unix copy program. It telephones and things like that. The bullet, it was on some bulletin boards, but it was mostly between academic and government people, because that's all the internet was at the time. There was a number of people on it in the late 80s, early 90s. Many of the names you'd be familiar with, Ben Smith, Russell Dushan, Terry Ann Wakeman, Bill Colosia. It just goes on and on with the various people. And Bill Colosia created the LRO list as a tangent for people just wanting to talk about Land Rovers, because the British Cars list had different groups of people that were either discussing Triumphs or MGBs or Morgans or Land Rovers, and just to sort out the volume of mail at the time, because that really was the only way to communicate with people at the time over a distance besides the post office or the telephone. There was quite a bit of volume there. And so the LRO list was born, expanded to a thousand people on it or more at one point in time, and just spanned the globe. And it was fantastic for, you know, getting people together to go to events and getting the clubs, especially North America, together. You know, if the LRO list had not existed, we would have never had the Anarch event at Greek Peak, for example, in 98, where you got Bay State Club with Jim Pappas got together with Rove under Sandy Grice, together with OVLR, with Christine Rose and so on, and ran that huge event that occurred down in central upstate New York. And the list, it's still running after Bill Colosia, unfortunately, sadly passed away. It was run out of my dining room for a while, and now is in the cloud.
So it has finally moved to the cloud, huh?
It is in the cloud right now, yes.
You guys were nice enough to host Fort Pitt Land Rover Group for a website for a good while. Appreciate that.
Yep. When I moved into this house in 98, as a temporary measure, a computer was set up in the corner of the dining room, and it's still there. And
still running?
Hosted, yep. Well, not the same computer, no.
Okay. All right.
We've gone to Unix and so on. It was originally a PC, and well, version of PC, running Unix. And one of the Arizona clubs was hosted there originally. The Rover Web was on it. The LRFAQ was on it. OVLR site was on it. But speed and efficiency, we've put portions into different cloud instances, as well as using the server here. So when you go onto the sites, you could be in any one of three locations. It's all done transparently.
So if one wanted to join the LRO list, and maybe you might get some additional folks doing that, what's the focus? What do people talk about? And I mean, I'm on there and I'm a member, but curious what...
Yeah, I am too, but I don't really talk that much, but I enjoy reading some of the stuff. But man, can that list diverge into an argument about oils and grease versus oil and the swivel housing.
Now, let's not bring up grease versus oil. Come on.
Put both in.
We don't have all frickin' night. So.
Topics are just all over the place.
But it seems like it's mainly more of a series-focused list.
It's a series-focused list now. Yeah. LRO-UK is the Brits, though there's a lot of Americans on that one. The South African one is active for the people down in South Africa. And so is the Australian one. There isn't that much volume now. A lot of people seem to have gone to Facebook and so on, which completely changes the dynamic. It is a medium of communication that is very standardized, is going to persist for a long time. And it's email that just flows into directories that you set up. And you can find any thread, any subject if you save these things. There's sites on the internet that have these emails stored, some of them in easily searchable and referenced things going back into the early 1990s. And the wealth of information in there is just huge.
Yeah, because there's discussion of, as Harold said, of you know, oil versus grease, but there's also looking for parts or trying to figure out how to repair something, especially in the series world. So that's it is actually a great resource.
Oh, I've used the LRO list as a reference source for writing articles for the OVLR newsletter for years.
So if folks want to check out the LRO list, we'll, of course, have a link in the show notes. You need to sign up, and you get a monthly notification. I think you still get that you're on the list, and you can set up a daily digest. I usually get the daily digest, by the way.
Yes, I haven't signed up for the list in such a long time. I actually have.
You know, that's right, yeah. But we'll have a link if you want to check it out and go sign up for it. You can do that and do like Harold and I do and kind of just lurk and listen in on the different conversations. I see Nick Danger occasionally will post something. Mark Love, those are people I know. It's also good for the birthday party, too, as that's coming up because a lot of those people are attending the birthday party.
The simplest way to find the list is just type in LRO space list space fourfold where it sits, and you should get a page coming up that gives you all the information on how to subscribe to it and such like that.
Yes, and any of its sublists. I didn't actually realize there were lists for other countries. I just thought there was one LRO list.
No, the British one is currently quite active in comparison.
What kind of things do they talk about?
All the same stuff that they do in North America. I never understood why you'd have, except for talking about events and so on, though the delete key, if you don't care, makes it easy. But people like to have their own lists and things like that. Okay, so they exist for that.
I assume they talk a lot more about Defenders, I assume, than they would maybe Series Truck?
About the same.
Okay. So you guys, and Fourfold, which I think is not just you, host all these lists?
That's right. Ben Smith down in New Jersey. Another person for you to go and chat with sometime.
Yes.
Yeah, he's much more into Unix than I am. You know, he's the main person going and running the lists and making them all go.
Thank you from the community for running those lists all these years. I'll extend that thank you to you on behalf of everybody. Is that all right?
Well, the credit really goes to Bill Colosia, who set this up back in 92 or 91 thereabouts and kept the thing going all the way till a couple of years ago. You know, through his effort in creating the lists that you started to get all the clubs to work together, popularize these events and such, because once that got going, it was just a sea change for the club scene. You had people from OVLR showing up at the Down East rally when it was going on. They come down to Mar, got you from Fort Pitt, people from New York, New Jersey, Maine, and so on, coming to the birthday party. It made something that up till that point was essentially fairly local, if not maybe regional, into something that was certainly regional and almost, taking over whole sections of the continent and so on, where the Northeast, East Coast, people knew what was going on in the different areas. And if you had time, you could now go down and participate in these events. And it made a huge difference, because people are able to communicate and exchange information, ideas, events, and so on, over that mailing list.
Didn't the list run off of a computer at Bill's house up until the day he died or something like that?
Yeah, past the day he died, though we had a copy of it from beforehand.
I vaguely remember some story about having to rescue the server from his house from his next of kin or something like that, and then they got it running. You guys, I guess, got it running after that.
Bill had given us a copy of the archives beforehand, but it ran at his place until he passed away. And then there was the huge scramble to go and get the server because it had the latest information on it. But we were able to go and stand the list up quickly using archived information. And then it was get the server to go and update everything and find the people that had been missed and so on in that period of time between them.
So you've also attended and met up with Morgan at the Vermont.
That British invasion.
Thank you. Invasion. Thanks, Morgan.
It was a brief meeting, but it was definitely good.
That event's changed a lot. It used to be on a field off the road that goes up to the notch and so on. And there was an RTV course there that was set up by Rovers North and so on. It was a very different event than what you see today. I think at the height it would get well over 100 Land Rovers, 120 Land Rovers that were appearing there before that side of it kind of collapsed.
I would say that this past year was actually a pretty good year for Land Rovers at British Invasion. It's been growing the last number of years, but it has been pretty pitiful.
Up until the early 2000s, OVLR used to show up there with a lot of people and vehicles from all over the place. It was almost kind of like they're hosting another OVLR event off to the side. We'd bring the Club Expedition trailer down there and, you know, serve ourselves food and so on. At the location in the fields where it used to be, there was no issue with people camping out there. You couldn't do that today in the park downtown Stowe. But
that's
true. Made it very accessible for people to go camping and things there, and made it, you know, very reasonable in terms of cost. But the British Invasion has always been an interesting event to go to. One of many. There's a long list of events. Winter Romp is obviously another. Mar is interesting. It's, you know, for a huge event, though much more defender-oriented and so on. But all of that, the exchange and so on of knowledge and the rest, was all coming through the LRO list, which then was used by Sandy Grice, myself, or Jim Pappas, put into the newsletters, which were the primary means of communication at the time, using dead trees to the bulk of the memberships to say, hey, here's this rally. Maybe you want to go to it. Different, and you'll have some fun.
Oh yeah, in the latest edition of the OVR newsletter, which you have started talking about, something to me is fascinating, is the Land Rovers and stamps.
One of my other boring hobbies is stamp collecting, primarily line and grave stamps from early England, the Victorian era, 1840s, generally 1850s. But back, and again on the LRO list, I and another chap by the name of T.F. Mills had a discussion about Land Rovers on stamps, and that started me going and looking and seeing, well, how many stamps would actually have a Land Rover on it? You know, there really can't be that many. And I'm past 150 now.
Really? Wow.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's far more than the instances of Land Rovers on money.
One.
One, yes.
I have a copy.
So there's three versions of it, but different colors and paper and so on.
Right.
Over the years, I've collected all of these stamps. Some of them are, you have the, you know, there's real legal stamps that were used as postage. You've got Cinderellas, in a sense, that are made by a third party for a country. You've got ones that are just blatantly legal stamps. Some that are made by revolutionary groups because they want the land, but they're not going to be let in there. There's just all sorts of things. And then, you know, from series to defenders to Range Rovers to police vehicles, military vehicles, fire vehicles. It was an interesting thing to do. So it's probably going to be about at this point, 12 to 18 part series to try and get them all, because there's just so many of them.
Wow.
And you can only fill in about two pages an issue of the newsletter as they do it anyway.
I guess they're not all then British then. I assume they're all around the world.
Oh, it's all around the world.
Yeah. Any American stamps?
No American stamps.
Of course not.
No Canadian either.
Really? I actually am surprised to hear that. I thought there would have been a Canadian one.
I think the American stamps were crushed at the border.
They're not old enough. You think Grizzly Torque would be a good opportunity to throw a Canadian Land Rover on a stamp?
Land Rover was a good enough vehicle that the first Land Rover stamp was in 57 for a vehicle that came out in 48. Huh. And for the mother company, Rover, the first Rover appeared on a stamp, I think, in 1980 or 81, 78 years after their first car.
Whoa.
So took a while.
Well, I think it helped Land Rover that the Queen is a fan.
Oh, yes. She's got a few of them.
And she doesn't need a driver's license. Little known fact.
The only person in the UK without one. One of the things on the LRO list early on was the frequently asked questions that developed, as people would always ask the same, you know, same questions. What kind of spark plug should I get? What kind of points or condensers and so on? And
grease versus oil.
Should I put oil in the swivel housing or grease? Yeah.
Well, back then, originally, you didn't have the one-shot grease for the Range Rover at the time, so it was just put in your 90 or 110 weight.
That was BMW's great gift.
So there was a frequently asked questions that was email that got lengthier and lengthier as time went by, until I took it over probably about 93. By about 95, we had put it onto a website, which eventually evolved into the OVLR website, the Land Rover FAQ website, and the Rover Web. Started off as the Rover Web. Now roverweb.org is where we're trying to go and collect all of the club magazines and newsletters and so on that used to exist in Canada and the United States in the past. And we're trying to PDF them all and put them up on that site. So they're there as a reference, because we've discovered some clubs, Prairie Rovers being a perfect example, that even the editor doesn't have any copies of any of the newsletters that were produced through the in through the 90s and so on.
Wow.
And it's a situation for a lot of clubs of like, where are back copies of your newsletter? Well, no one kept any of them, which is
unfortunate.
That's a shame.
Well, that's
at least with OVLR, just about all of the 407 newsletters we've produced since 84 are actually up online. Land Rover Owners Association of the U.S., we've got most of their newsletters up online. ALROC's newsletters, a lot of them are up online. But as we're trying to go and find all of the old club newsletters, and so we can digitize them, PDF them, and put them up so people can actually go and see what's going on at the time, because there's, again, they're a fantastic reference material, because someone, of course, has written about grease versus oil at least four or five times, and you can go see who may have been their act together on the subject.
Now, that's all on the OVLR website?
The OVLR website is, the three of them are kind of linked, but they are separate domains.
Okay.
They all have a similar look and feel. The OVLR website's kind of red. LRFAQ is green. The base color and the Rover web is blue.
But if one found themselves on the OVLR website, there'd be links to take them elsewhere.
That's right.
Okay.
They're cross-linked between each other.
And if any of our listeners happen to have some of this old material that's printed in these newsletters, what's the best way to contact you, or should they scan it in themselves? And then, you know, email it
if
to you.
If they ideal, the best way to do it is to go and just, if you can scan it, make a PDF of it and send it to me at dkenner@gmail.com, and we will get these things onto the Rover web. Dead tree version, not many people probably want to mail packets of these things, but I guess in the show notes you can go and put an address or something down to go and mail them. But
yeah, if they want to mail, ideally, we'll contact you and we can figure that out.
Yep.
Or contact, put them in touch.
Well, depending on what country they're from, that could be a good way to use a Land Rover postage stamp.
That's true.
Or drive them. Go to the birthday party, bring your old copies of newsletters with you, attend the birthday party, and hand deliver them.
Well, the other way is another offshoot of the LRO list, the Rover Underground Railroad. RURR, which tends to move parts up and down the U.S. Canadian coasts and so on, and back and forth.
We've used that ourselves.
I guess that's an offshoot also of the LRO then, right? Because there was probably communication.
Yeah. As a recent example from 2 years ago, hi, I bought a winch from Ike Goss out at Pangolin. I need to get the thing to the East Coast. Well, that winch went from Oregon down to Central California, where it was picked up by another person who brought it to further to Southern California, where it was put onto a DC-3, flown to Florida, and then worked its way up the coast to further north.
What's the DC-3 connection? That's interesting.
Yeah.
A couple of the Land Rover owners, series Land Rover owners, fly a DC-3. If you think that series Land Rover people are pack rats, we are absolute rank amateurs in comparison to someone with the DC-3. They use kiddie pools under the engines to catch the oil.
Oh, yeah.
And the parts are, you know, in a hangar, the parts just go to the roof. But
yeah, because if you don't save the parts, you're making them next time you need them.
There's still a lot of DC-3s flying. You know, they're the equivalent of a series Land Rover. The LRO list took a lot of small parochial clubs like Bay Street, OVLR, Rove, and so on, and turned them into much larger regional clubs and really got them working together. And you knew about events up and down the coast, and it really started people mixing. You know, that list was what really got it. It's what made OVLR go from a club of probably, you know, 40, 50 people to, I think at one point it hit nearly 300. Now it's down to 150 or something like that. The LRO list and what Bill Colosi and so on did was, you know, what was behind all of this.
Yep. Connects
and you just don't get the same thing from Facebook. Try and find someone's post from 2 days ago.
I would agree there. Yeah, brought the community together. It made a community, really, in many ways, because people were kind of isolated previous to that. You probably would see a series truck drive by, and you'd go out and follow them, and that's how you met another series truck owner. Now it's a little easier and has become easier thanks to the LRO list. Mm-hmm. And it's
Fort Pitt grew out of Scott Wickham, Russell Wilson, and John Humphreys, and so on, being on the LRO list and showing up to the birthday party and so on. And the next thing you know, they created Fort Pitt.
Well, Dixon, thanks again for coming on the show. Thanks for what you've done for the community, especially here in North America and the LRO list and keeping it going. I know it's not just you, but you are the person we're talking to about it right now. And so I want to thank you for that. And thanks for coming on the show.
No problem.
And hopefully we'll see you at the birthday party or maybe at another event. I know you get around to events, especially here on the East Coast. Our listeners can look out for Dixon, and I'm sure you'll provide them with some additional stories that you couldn't say in broadcast, right?
Especially when we start talking about borders.
There we go. Maybe I tell you, how about this? If our listeners see you, they should buy you a beer as a thank you for what you've done for the Land Rover community. There we go. That's a good way to end that. Buy Dixon a beer. There we go. Thanks again, Dixon.
No problem.
Bye-bye. And that's the Center Steer podcast for March 2019. I want to thank Dixon for being our guest this month and also joining us for the news. So, Dixon, since you're still with us, thanks very much for coming on, talking to us about OVLR, the birthday party, and the OLR, the LRO list.
Got lots to talk about.
Yes, we did.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Anytime. And hopefully you'll come back. Did we pass the audition?
I think you did. Yes, you did.
All right. Hopefully.
There's a lot of other things to talk about, too, in the world. Land Rover.
Indeed there are. And also thanks to Abel for his continuing help of the show by selling Range Rover winches. And a thanks to PAX, the one true PAX, for his continued production support, which should continue even though we're getting a new mixer. Visit our website, centersteer.com, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to our stories discussed in today's show. I remind you that we're part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and you can check out the other 4x4 related shows at 4x4radionetwork.com. You can connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can directly support the show at patreon.com/centersteer. You can send us an email if you like to. If you're not a subscriber, please do so you get the show automatically. It'll show up in your very favorite podcast app. And you can show your support for the podcast with a t-shirt or sticker through our website. There's a shop link on the website. And thanks to Morgan and Dixon and Harold for coming on and joining us the show. Thanks very much, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having me. $10 is $10.
And I remind you, we'll be headed to Rovers at Wintergreen and also to the Sand Rover Rally. Stop, say hi, maybe even buy a shirt. Help support the show. Appreciate it.
Around later in April, there's going to be the Maple Syrup Rally up near Ottawa that you could come on up to. Second oldest rally in North America for Land Rovers. Birthday party is the oldest one.
And the birthday party is the June 21st this year, is right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. 21st, 22nd, 23rd.
I will make serious consideration of those two events also, but that doesn't mean our listeners, they can go also.
Very true.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed show number 72. We'd love to hear from you and what you're up to in your Land Rover. Until next time, I ask you to share the show with one other Land Rover enthusiast.
And you may now resume your important things.
Kilometer, so it's the triangle of evil.